and welcome geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, lovers of freedom, fairness and democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight. Boy, I got to tell you, the tea must be flowing, or the green tea anyway, because if you've seen the reports, our little minx there in Delaware has raised $1 million in just about one night. So we are 46 days out, and the woman who reported officially that she earned $5,800 in the last year and gave herself, her campaign, over 3,000 of that $5,800, now has $1 million handed to her by, I'm kind of out of my league here on this one. Who in their right mind would send this woman money? Anyway, her Kirsten Miller was her 2008 campaign manager, and I think this is interesting. During the 2008, she made a phone call to the Delaware voters telling them that O'Donnell was, quote, living on campaign donations, using them for rent and personal expenses while leaving her workers unpaid and piling up thousands in debt, and that she wasn't concerned about conservative causes. O'Donnell just wanted to make a quick buck. And, gee, are you surprised by that? I got to tell you, though, that statement worries me, because how somebody runs their campaign is how they're going to run their office and how they're going to vote and how they're going to treat the American people. So when you take those donations that people are saying, hey, go out there and do the hard work of buying the ads and getting your message out, when you're taking that money and stuffing it in your pocket, not paying your staff, I got a problem with that. When you're running up big debt, I got a problem with that. And again, you know, she reported officially $5,800 as a marketing consultant. Gave herself over $3,000 for her campaign. You know, how do you live? I know Delaware is not a big state, and I don't know how you live on $2,700. When the Weekly Standard asked her about this, Jake, she said, the only thing they can use against me is I'm not a multimillionaire. I think she's got the Palin speak down. And you asked last night if she was wealthy, Jake. And according to ABC News, in March, the IRS initiated an audit and placed a lien against her for $11,744.59 in taxes and penalties from the year 2005. Since 1994, according to ABC News, Farley Dickinson University, you know, where she, you know, she graduated for years and years ago, and, oh, well, gee, wait a minute, they wouldn't give me my diploma because I hadn't paid for it. She said they had to sue O'Donnell five times for outstanding debts of about $5,000. But what she kept saying is, oh, I completed my work. Politico called the school, and she didn't get her degree because she didn't complete her work. And again, you know, these are all those, you say dumb stuff, it comes back to bite you.
Wasn't that what Karl Rove, I think, Karl Rove is an operative. He knows what's going on.
Exactly.
And he questioned her integrity, he questioned her honesty. But have you heard the latest? I mean, this seems like a story that keeps repeating itself. Rush Limbaugh was all over Karl Rove. He was just furious. And when Karl Rove was interviewed on Fox News the night before, you know, Sean Hannity kind of got upset with him at the time. There was a, well, shall we say, an outburst in the Republican Party. Some of those people who you would think would react to Karl Rove's statement, don't you know it? The next day, Karl Rove is kind of backtracking. Karl Rove, who's an extremely powerful man in the Bush White House, architect of many Bush family victories, if you know his history, is now backtracking and saying, well, you know, I'm not against her. I'm going to support her. She's the candidate, and you have to respect the process. That seems to be their word to make excuses for things that they said, but they can't take it back. Neither can Mr. Castle, the former governor, who actually called the president, said he's not gonna support this woman. So those are the kind of things that if I was the Democrat running against her, I would play them constantly.
Oh, absolutely. But the reality is, look, the party is in, I'm loving it. I'm loving that infighting because what has happened.
They're devouring themselves.
Right. It's what's happened to the Democrats for the last several years. The big tent party. You know, we talk about our diversity in the Democratic Party, but it's also one of the weaknesses. And we're seeing now that the Republicans may not be able to hold on to the fringe. The fringe has gained some steam. And, you know, I look at what the Times reported. It said in the campaign's final weeks, her Republican opponents constantly raised the issues of, you know, her money. But none of it was enough to dampen the Tea Party enthusiasm that propelled her to victory. So, you know, they knew all this before they went into the voting polls. They knew that she you know, lied about her education. They knew that she basically, and I think the IRS has got to look into how a single person in this country makes it on $5,800 in a year. I think you have to look at that. But they knew all this, and 30,000 people in the state of Delaware voted for her anyway. And, you know, I go back to that quote from her former campaign manager who's saying, look, she doesn't really believe this stuff. It's a job. That's mm-hmm. what I see the majority of the conservative movement saying and doing. You look at Rush Limbaugh. I had a conversation with a guy who I'm not really sure if he's how conservative he is, but he claims to be. He said, look, Limbaugh's an entertainer. Rupert Murdoch's a businessman. Fox News was a business opportunity. If the entire culture were conservative, he would probably be starting a liberal network. It's about business. And all of this is, all of this feigned outrage and all of this fanning the flames, if you will, it's all about just grabbing people in and saying, hey, look at us, look at them, hey, listen to our advertisers. You know, when Limbaugh says he's the, you know, defender of corporate America, that's what's important to him. That's what's important. All this little conflict that they're creating. I got to be honest. I don't doubt that you had the Roves and the Luntzes and all these people in a room going, how can we use this to our advantage? And all this stuff to me is scripted out. It's playing out right before our eyes, and it's beautiful to watch. But I then have to question, you know, this woman who, honestly and truthfully, I don't know how you live on $5,800 a year without any side income. So she's got to be using some campaign money. I don't know that, but I, you know, just basic deduction. Is she going to be like Mama Bear? Is she going to be like Grizzly Bear when she's elected to the Senate and another opportunity comes along? Is she going to fly off and go, hey, you know what? I'm not a multimillionaire, but you know what? This $180,000 or whatever a senator makes, not enough for me. I want to do TV. I want to write books. I want to sing songs. I want to sing. And, you know, we'll see her on American Idol, and we'll see her on Dancing with Tip-Tap-Toeing with the Idiots on Dancing with the Stars. And and just like Mama Bear, just like Mama Grizzly, loading up the pockets. The golden lining, man. And you can't deny this, that these are opportunists, Jake.
Absolutely. Oh, and I forgot to mention, Sarah Palin came out and really excoriated, you know, Karl Rove. So apparently, you know, she's kind of inching up on Rush Limbaugh as someone that has a lot of leverage in the party. And, wow, I think that's even more scary than Rush Limbaugh being the titular head of the party.
I love it. But, you know, I love the advice that Sarah Palin gave to Christine O'Donnell. Do we have that clip available, Brett? You'll love this. She was talking to Bill O'Reilly, and she was saying, well, you know, what Christine O'Donnell needs to do is she needs to get her message out. She needs to go to the people and get her message out.
Get out there, speak to the American people, speak through Fox News, and let them, the independents who are tuning into you, let them know what it is that she stands for.
Speak through Fox News. Don't go anywhere else. Don't answer any real questions. And if I get this, and if I remember right, I read a story that she's not going to debate unless she has the questions in advance. I mean, this is really very, very insane.
It sounds like Mrs. Engel out in Nevada. Well, exactly.
Well, they want to know how crazy they can be. I mean, when they're themselves, when you get them in a situation where they are themselves, they're nuts.
Wow.
And we got 46 days to election. Folks, we got to wake up. And when we come back, we want to talk a little bit more about this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. We're right back after this. Stick around.
Well, hey, the working man like me. I ain't never been on welfare, and that's one place I won't be. I'll be working as long as my two hands are fit to use. I'll drink my beer in a tavern, sing a little bit of these working men.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith. Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. International Association of Machinists members could strike at Cessna Aircraft. The union is urging its members to vote no on a proposed 7-year contract from the company and to authorize a strike. Voting is set for Saturday, just a day before the old contract expires. Machinists District 70 says Cessna wants permanent cuts with no hope of improvement, even in economic good times, for the duration of the 7-year contract. The contract proposal would force union workers to switch to a different health care plan with a 160% increase in premium payments. The health care switch would cost workers an average of $4,000 to $5,000 more per year, according to the union. The machinists represent 2,400 workers at Cessna. The next time you're at your local bank's teller window, SEIU wants you to bring their bank employee whistleblower card with you. That card explains how the Wall Street Reform Law protects bank employees who blow the whistle on predatory and illegal banking practices. SEIU says it consistently hears from bank employees that they're forced to push unsafe and unnecessary financial products on customers. SEIU launched a campaign this week to present the whistleblower cards to bank employees to make sure bank workers are aware of their new rights and protections. For more information on this SEIU campaign, go to action.seiu.org/bankwatch. The RWDSU acceptance of a deal ending the Dr. Pepper Snapple Mott's strike accepted a pay freeze, but not the $1.50 an hour pay cut that the profitable company tried to impose. The union also says the 3-year deal this week ending the 16-week strike does not include a pensions freeze. Newly hired workers, though, will be switched to 401k plans. Most Harley workers in Wisconsin will keep their jobs after grudgingly conceding to concessions this week. The tentative deal includes a pay freeze, hundreds of job cuts, and assigning other work to part-time workers, but it also saves hundreds of jobs. Harley had threatened to move the jobs out of Wisconsin if it didn't get the cuts it wanted. Just 10% of restaurant workers in the United States get health insurance and sick days. Jesse Russell reports.
90% of restaurant workers are not offered health insurance or sick days. That's according to restaurant worker advocacy organization Restaurant Opportunity Centers United. In 2008, the average earnings for workers in the industry were less than $13,000. 2,500 workers were surveyed in 5 cities, and 38% said they are forced to work off the clock. The federal minimum wage for waitstaff has remained at $2.13 per hour since 1991.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show. Progressive talk with a conscience.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unborn lines, sitting around waiting for a
Standing in the unemployment lines. You know, the thing that bothers me, we don't do that anymore. This is another one of those wonderful things that government has, that the slashers of government have figured out how to do. We now apply for unemployment compensation benefits over the telephone. We don't actually have to go down to the office anymore and stand in line. So you're not seeing other unemployed people. You're not coming together. You're really stop and think about this stuff for a couple of minutes. How well they've kept us apart. How well we've been divided and sliced and diced. And the one thing that I do give the Tea Party credit for, even if I do think they're off on they're off the reservation, is that they are doing the hard work of organizing. Even if they are misguided by the corporate special interest. And I look it out in California, Meg Whitman, the Republican candidate for governor out there. So far, she has spent $119 million out of her bank account, surpassing Michael Bloomberg, who spent $109 million out of his own pocket. And what's amazing to me is Whitman's not even running away with this election, which tells you how bad of a candidate she is. And I love the fact that she's out there saying, well, you know, money can't buy elections. Voters are too smart. Yeah. They see you out there spending like, a Republican. And they're saying, we don't want more of that. Let's take a quick call. We got Sue on line one. How are we doing today, Sue?
Hi, Rick. May I make a rather snarky comment about these right-wing women Tea Party candidates?
Let's hear it.
I figure. Have you noticed that they all bear a distinct resemblance to a rabid weasel?
A rabid weasel?
That's what they strike me as. I'm sorry, they just do.
Well, you know what they strike me as? Look, they were the mean, angry girls when you were in school. They were the ones who did some really nasty stuff. They were the ones who got went out and drinking and carousing and all that. And then they, like George Bush, like Glenn Beck, they found Jesus. And now they're the dry drunk. Now they're the anti-smoker. I don't know if you've ever been around a former smoker. There's nobody worse than a former smoker or a former drinker. And those are the people who are trying to take over this country, Sue.
Oh, yeah. Can you spell theocracy?
Oh, please, please. I mean, you look at this thing in New York with the mosque. You would think that the Republicans would have been all for defending the Constitution, defending property rights.
Right.
But now, not so much. Not so much at all.
Well, they only want their part of their Constitution, not the entire.
Yeah, that's it.
It makes me glad I'm very close to the Canadian border. I may need to run for it.
Please don't make a run. We need you. We need people to stay here and fight back.
I won't run unless I absolutely have to, which means the day Sarah Palin is sworn in as president, that's when I run.
Sue, that's never going to happen. The office doesn't pay enough.
That's what I'm praying for.
The office doesn't pay enough. Come on. We all know gold diggers like this. It's all about the money. She'll say, do, tap dance, sing, whatever you need her to do, as long as you're paying her. It's that simple.
Yeah. Well, there's a word for her, but I won't use it on terrestrial radio.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Sue. Thanks so much for the call. I appreciate it. You know, the reality is, look, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425, if you want to weigh in on this. Look, you know, it's not that I'm attacking them personally. I'm attacking the caricature of what they are. You know, when you looked at Bush, you knew he was the dry drunk. You could see it in his eyes. And I've had friends, and I'm sure you have had too, who were, you know, they were alcoholics or they were drug addicts or, you know, whatever. They had their addiction. And they were decent people. I mean, you could hang around with them. You know, they had their problems, but they were decent people. As soon as they found that 12 steps, as soon as they traded one addiction for the other, man, most of them were insufferable. They were intolerable.
One obsession for the other, absolutely.
And what frustrates me about it is these are the people who now want to run the country. And they want to tell people like you and me that all the things that they've done, you can't do. You know, it's just mind-blowing. Absolutely mind-blowing. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. But, you know, again, I think November is going to be fun. I think these 46 days are going to be filled with walking comedy, because I think she's a walking punchline.
Well, it seems like, you know, the far right, I consider these people far right. It's like qualifications don't really mean anything as long as you're a true believer. That's what counts. It's ideology. It's not qualifications. I mean, we see that over and over and over again. We have people that haven't voted for 30 years, for God's sakes. Now they want to come in. They want to tell us how to live.
I'm not sure that's the way
we want to go.
No, Jake. We want government out of our lives. Oh, we want government. We want small government out of our lives, except in your bedroom or what it is that you drink or smoke or whatever it is you do. Because, oh, that's bad. It's amazing to me. I mean, the hypocrisy. I mean, the mosque that really wasn't a mosque at Ground Zero that wasn't at Ground Zero is one of those things that kind of has caught my attention. Because, look, they said, maybe it's not at Ground Zero. Well, maybe it's not. But it's two blocks away. Well, what if they proposed putting it four blocks away, or five, or six, or ten? Would that still be too close? Can I get a ruling? Can I get an official ruling on how far we can build something? Because the American people don't want it there. I got to tell you, I don't want a church in my neighborhood. I'm tired of seeing all these churches popping up.
All of a sudden, property rights, they don't matter. Neither do constitutional rights, actually, when their political ideology gets in the way. You're right, they are, in many instances, just one big group of hypocrites.
Look, most of them reach around behind, and they pop their ideology right out of the dark side of the moon. That's basically what it is. And, you know, the reason that we will never get Christine O'Donnell on this program is she will never answer an honest question. When Sarah Palin said, go through Fox News, yes, because she knows they're like campaign people. They're going to help her. And I had an interesting conversation with somebody today who said, you know, well, talk radio has been taken over by the right because of the illusion that conservatives are under attack. And I said, well, conservatives seem to always feel like they're under attack. They need that. That's their personality. They need to feel that, oh, my God, they're coming for me. We need to defend ourselves. And, you know, I got a buddy of mine who's a big gun advocate. I'm not going to say gun nut. Well, I guess I just did. Anyway, he's a big gun advocate, and he talks about hoping and praying for the day someone breaks into his house, like it's some erotic fantasy. And he really gets into it. I mean, he gave me a whole 20-minute whole dissertation there on how he would do it, and I'm going, this sounds pornographic to me. You've put way too much thought into somebody breaking into your house, and you pulling out your big one. I'm going to get them, and I'm going to really stick it to them. I'm going to get my big gun. And these are the kind of people that scare me, Jake.
Well,
I think they should scare all of us, because they're a very small percentage, way out of
the letter O, once again, obsession. You talk to those people, the ones that and I worked with some of them. They would talk for hours about hunting and their guns, and which is better than, well, what I'm saying is, that seems to be their whole life.
Well, you talk about politics.
It was guns, and it was, well, but you can reach a point. You know, sports is one thing when you're talking about a gun that can kill people.
Guns don't kill people.
Well, yes, they do.
People kill people.
That's crap. My point is, they were obsessed. They were absolutely obsessed. It all revolved around their Second Amendment rights, and I really don't see where they're coming from on that issue, but they've been told repeatedly that you have to be ever vigilant in any law at all. Any law at all. And that's where I have a problem with the NRA. Any law at all that, even if it's reasonable, is the first step in taking away their guns. And that's why I think many of us that are moderates who are on the left, we really look at the NRA with a jaundiced eye.
Well, I mean, at the end of it, I don't want the government come taking guns either. But I just don't think that my neighbor needs a cannon.
But there's reasonable restrictions without taking away your constitutional rights.
And when you're talking about any extremist position, which is what we like to point out here, but when you talk about any extremist position, then you've got problems. I don't want our government coming and taking, rounding up people's guns. I don't think it's a good thing. I think an armed populace has some positive effects, simply. Although I don't want them having, you know, automatic weapons or tanks or rocket launchers, that's not a good thing either. So for me, it's not about that. It's about keeping things sane. And we're going to take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK. We're right back after this.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Some politicians say the unemployed won't look for work until their benefits run out.
Ed has been laid off from his pipe fitting job for over 18 months.
I'm here to tell you, being out of work is no fun. It sets you back in life. Benefits provide for less than half your wages. There's no health care, and your family suffers. To those politicians who think anybody would rather be collecting unemployment than working, I say come join us. We won't forget on Election Day.
This Labor Day message brought to you by the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO, Richard Bloomingdale President, Frank Snyder, Secretary Treasurer.
Workers in the late 1930s began exerting their recently guaranteed right to organize and join unions. Millions of workers flocked to join the labor organization of their choosing to collectively bargain for better wages, hours, and working conditions. Factory, mill, and mine owners, not eager to embrace the changes, fought vehemently to deny workers their rights. As company tactics grew more heavy-handed and brutal, the workers' organizing methods changed. Sit-down strikes became a way for workers to demand their rights and to force management to listen. With a wave of a handkerchief, the tip of a hat, workers would shut down their machines, lay down their hammer, and sit down. Workers at the Hershey Chocolate Factory in Hershey, Pennsylvania, seeking to reduce the 60-hour-long work week, decided to form a union. Initially, an agreement was reached, but as the economy took a downturn, the company willfully violated the agreement by laying off the most senior workers, those who just happened to be the most ardent union supporters. The workers voted to strike the very next day. At 11 a.m. on April 2nd, 1937, a red handkerchief was waved and the workers began their first sit-down strike in Pennsylvania's history. The company reacted by forming the Loyal Workers Club. These strikebreakers consisted of hired thugs from New York City and local farmers, dairy producers, and shopkeepers who were dependent on the factory. On April 6, Hershey organized a loyalty parade. After hours of rallying speeches, the lathered-up Loyal Workers Club mob found pipes and clubs that had been manufactured at the Hershey planing mill. The angry mob headed to the Hershey factory to throw their strikers out. Songs of solidarity sung by the striking workers could be heard from inside the factory as the angry mob burst into the plant. Blocking the only exit, the Loyal Workers Club, loyal only to management and greed, began pummeling the workers as they tried to escape. The assault left numerous workers bloody and beaten, many unconscious. Within days, Hershey reopened and recognized the renamed version of the Loyal Workers Club. In May of 1938, the National Labor Relations Board ruled Hershey had violated the law and the company union was dissolved. Soon the workers joined the Bakery and Confectionery Workers Local 464, who have faithfully represented the workers ever since. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
And the green, though, she's about working class families and bringing them out of financial crisis and tragedies. She wants to expose the banks. And
the man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
Honestly, I like Elizabeth Warren. I like the idea of making her the head of this new agency. But I really don't like that song.
Why not?
I'm just not a rap fan. You know, if that's what that is, whatever it is, I'm just not fond of it. But I am fond of the appointment. I think she will do a good job. I think she's got it, Jake. I think she understands that the working class in this country has been devastated for the last 30 years, and she's been under attack for her positions. And the right, you know, look, the extreme right, the banking industry, they want no part of her. They want absolutely no part of her because if she starts going after some of the things that they're doing, no more big bonuses, no more lavish trips. And you think of some of the products that banks have been using through the years to really stick it to the lower end of the economic scale. You know, some like extended warranties on autos and gap insurance and some of the other things and the debit card nonsense. At some point, folks, you got to put these people back under control. And I look at the fact that, you know, Pat Toomey voted to take the reins off. Let big banks go do whatever they can do. Get out there and become a casino, if you will. And I'm hoping that this woman, through this advisory role, because evidently the president, and this is where people, you know, this is where people have a problem with this president, and I am one of them. You have to be honest. He has not taken the leadership that we had hoped he was going to take. And I think what the left thought, and I think what Democrats thought, is that this president would be the kind of Democrat we were hoping for. I knew he was not. I during the election, we talked about this ad nauseum. I knew he was not that Bushian character where he was going to take the reins and demand his will be done. He's a consensus builder. He's a delegator. We should have known that. But the expectations on him were so great, Jake, that we thought that he was going to come in and he was going to, this is my plan, get it done. And that's not what happened.
I think a good analogy would be a good ball player, good baseball player. Good baseball player isn't necessarily a good manager because they're entirely different roles. And I do believe, but to be fair, I think, quite frankly, in the last couple months, he shows signs of getting better. But I agree with you in general. I think his basic political instincts were to compromise. His basic political instincts were consensus, and that worked in the Senate. It's worked his whole political career. But now you're leading the ship. It's a little bit different. You've got to be ahead. You should be the one leading instead of the one behind the scenes.
Right.
It's a big difference. And I do think he's learned some tough lessons. I think he's starting to learn. He better start learning.
Well,
because if he doesn't, his second term is very much in question.
The difference is between politics and governing. And governing is what he's trying to do. What he's failing at is politics. He's trying to fix the problems that face this country. He's trying to dig us out of the worst economic crisis that probably all of us alive have ever seen. But politically, he's not out there selling the message and reassuring the very uneasy majority in this country who are seeing changes, and they're not seeing it really affect their lives yet, but they're... You know, and they're hearing all this, oh, we're spending, and they're thinking about their kitchen table, and they're going, oh, my gosh, you know, we're going to be broke. And I blame that on the right, because they have had a unified opposition to this president from day one. And they told you they were going to. They told you right away, I hope he fails. And they were honest about it, just like they're honest this November. Look. If they take back control of the House and they get some, they may not take over the Senate, but if they get a good number in the Senate, you are going to see nothing but obstruction, gridlock, and investigations. They are going to investigate everything that moves, is nailed down, or was ever imagined to be there. Why? So they can do what the Bush administration did, stall out the clock, just hold the ball. Until 2012. In fact, they want another government shutdown. They want to go back and relive the Gingrich years. They want to go back because they got their butts kicked so bad the last time. They want to go back for round two.
Well, you hear the man who's going to be the senator from Alaska. He's publicly said, I want to shut down government. He said it. He wasn't playing games. He wasn't hiding it. you know, it wasn't an agenda that he's not talking about. He said publicly, I want to shut down government.
You know, and bringing this back to Elizabeth Warren, who I think is an excellent person for this post. I would have, and, you know, here's my problem is I would have told the Republicans, right when I took office in 2009, if I were President Obama, I would have said, here's a special seat for you. When I hear from you, I will ask. We're going to fix this country. We're going to fix everything that you screwed up. I don't want to hear a peep out of you. You're the one who did this. Sit down and shut up. That's what I would have done. But then again, I don't think I'm a consensus builder. But here's the thing. You would have had my agenda. You would have had health care by now. You would have had a stimulus package big enough to get this economy moving again. We wouldn't have had the obstruction and the delay and all of the stuff that Obama allowed to happen by saying, oh, let me reach out to you and have you kick me in the backside every chance you get. Oh, yes, please do it again. Because I believe in governance. They don't. They hate you. And what's bothered me, and I had lunch with a guy today who on the other side, and we agreed, what bothers us is the extremists have taken over. His example was Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill may have hated each other and beat each other up in public and did all those things, but at the end of the day, they sat down, had a drink and a cigar.
They actually on a regular basis, ate meals together.
Yep.
Broke bread, and they probably liked each other on a personal level.
Sure, but politically they were opposed.
Yes.
But at the end of the day, you still had to do the job of government. And what's going on here is we've paid a Republican Party to sit for 2 years and do nothing but obstruct and hold up progress and hold up the will of the people, which, if you remember in 2008, was health care. And this health care bill we got, and I'm going to talk to you a little bit later about some numbers that are out, we didn't get it done. And I think that's what really has people upset and why you're seeing some Democrats who may think that the party's demoralized. Look, I'm telling you right now, if you don't go out and vote in November, you absolutely deserve everything you get the next 2 years. That's not a threat. That's a promise. We are going to deserve the government that we get. And if the Pat Toomeys of the world and all of these T-Twizzlers get in, we're going to deserve what we get. And that is slashed budgets. That is massive pain for those at the middle to lower end of the economic scale, Jake. Seniors, you're not getting away easy either. You're going to see help programs like LIHEAP cut. You're going to see social programs to help the elderly and just slashed and burned. I mean, Tom Corbett says he's not cutting, you know, well, we don't want to cut we don't want to cut any programs, but I'm not going to raise any taxes. So how are you going to pay for it? You do it one of two ways. You're either going to cut stuff or you're going to raise taxes. Simple. And really, to say anything other than that is being disingenuous. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. If you've got a thought on this. And you know what? When I look at this, our friend the Tan Man, oh, Mr. Tan Man, the agency France Press reports today that the top Republican in the House of Representatives, our friend Tan Man, called Thursday for a full extension of the tax cuts enacted during the Bush administration, rejecting any compromise with the president. Basically, Tan Man said Republicans in the House and Senate are united that this is not the time to increase taxes on anyone in America. Even in a time when we can't afford them, they're all for keeping the $700 billion over the next 2 years into the hands of the very wealthy. Now, look, what the president has called for. Said, look, we don't want to raise anyone's, we don't want to raise taxes. But somebody has to. Somebody's got to pay for the things that we need. The debt has to be serviced from somewhere. Who should we get it from? Should we get it from the guy who making minimum wage at a fast food joint? Should we get it from Christine O'Donnell, who made $5,800 last year? and gave herself over $3,000 for her campaign? Should we, or should we get it from Warren Buffett, who has said, please, tax me. I want to save my country. Please, tax me.
Rick, you don't get it. According to Mitch McConnell, and he wouldn't lie to us, those who were hurt the most during the recession were the very wealthy.
He
actually said that in the well of the U.S. Senate with a straight face.
Yes, he did.
Now, how many different ways is he wrong on that statement? Does he really think even those on the right are going to accept that argument? You might say, I think these people deserve it. I think they've created wealth, even though some of them have, some of them haven't. To use that argument, at least you'd have some legitimacy. But to say we should allow them to have these tax breaks because they are the ones that suffered the most in the economic downturn is ludicrous.
They couldn't have extra cheese on their Whopper. When we come back, you know, and I hear this all the time. Rick, you're talking about class warfare. Well, let's take a look at what class warfare looks like from our friends over at Working America. We're right back after this. Stick around. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. We're right back.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Hello, I'm David Thillman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. A union of over 1.4 million strong and growing, AFSCME is gaining improvements in the workplace all across America. And right here in the Commonwealth, more than 95,000 AFSCME members make Pennsylvania happen. Highways, libraries, hospitals, parks, offices, prisons, classrooms, museums, courtrooms. You'll find AFSCME members at work in all these places and many more.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
Today's AFSCME members take on public service jobs as diverse as they are, not for the recognition, but for a better Pennsylvania. For more information, please visit our website at AFSCME13.org. Labor is changing. So is your labor union. We are AFSCME.
Why do airline executives hate their customers? Not so very long ago, airlines boasted about flying the friendly skies. But that happy slogan has now been perverted into flying the abusive skies. For example, what does a ticket cost? The airlines won't come clean even on this basic question. We do know that stated ticket prices have been steadily rising with double-digit increases in the past year. But that price is merely the starting point for today's airline hucksters. The real gouging is in the frenzy of fees the airlines have invented, many of which are not even disclosed to us and most of which are simply unwarranted. Last year, airline fees totaled nearly $8 billion, a consumer subsidy siphoned right out of our pockets into the corporate coffers. Take the ticket change fee. If something comes up, forcing you to change a flight from the one you'd booked, you're hit with a service fee of $150. Plus, you must pay the difference if your new flight is priced higher, which it will be. What a ripoff! This rebooking service is done by computer, costing the airline more like $150 rather than $150. Also, notice that airlines themselves routinely cancel or delay flights, forcing us into inconvenient and thoroughly unpleasant travel changes. Yet, they don't pay us $150 for their changes. American Airlines, however, has generously offered to cut its rebooking fee in half if you pay a flexibility fee of $19 when you book your flight. Then, any changes you need to make later will only cost you $75. Yes, it's a fee to reduce your fee. This is Jim Hightower saying, these infuriating fees are unnecessary. Southwest Airlines, for example, refuses to charge for any service that's historically been free to customers, and Southwest is profitable.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book titled Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, now available wherever books are sold.
Officially in love with Michelle Bachman, even if she's batshit crazy. Rick Smith.
Yeah, government may be about service, but politics is about winning. See, that crazy guy would have had a couple minutes with the president. Maybe he could have helped us out a little bit. Maybe this appointment to an advisory role now for Elizabeth Warren would have been an actual appointment. But you know, here's the thing: you got Barney Franks coming out saying, "Well, you know, she didn't want a permanent appointment." Really? Are you kidding? Come on, Barney. You're better than that. Anyway, what I get often, and if you listen to the program, I do beat up on the investor class because they need it every once in a while. You need to bring them down a notch. But what I get is I get, Rick, well, all you're talking about is class warfare. Well, our friends over at Working America have an interesting set of things to ask you about class warfare. And what they're saying, this is what class warfare looks like. And they ask you if you see a pattern. They write, increasing income disparity in the U.S. puts us worse than or on par with much of Latin America. And if you saw the report recently, the disparity between those who have and those who have not put us right there with most Latin American countries. And we like to think that we're better than they are because, we can buy cheap trinkets from Walmart. But the reality is when you look at the economic data, We're no better than the Latin American countries when it comes to the gulf between those who have and those who have not. Here in the U.S., a former economic advisor to George W. Bush and John McCain had advocated for lowering the minimum wage. You want to talk about class warfare, Jake? I think that's one of the first. It's another shot. Another shot in the class warfare. I say the first shot in the class warfare came from Reagan when he fired the Patco workers, and we've been seeing shot after shot after shot. Someone making $100 million a year paying just 2% more than someone making $175,000 a year. I got a problem with that. So you got one of these big CEOs who decides, I'm going to take myself a big $100 million slice of the pie that those poor working schlubs made, and I'm going to stuff it into my pocket. And I'm going to pay 2% higher than those folks? Not happening. And what we see, Wall Street bonuses are on the rise, while on the picket lines for Mott's and Express Script, you're seeing them saying, well, you need to take a pay cut because times are tough. Times are tough, Jake. But the CEO, man, he's going, well, I'm navigating us through rough waters. I deserve a raise.
And what's the ultimate effect of that? And we don't talk about it enough. We talk about the demise of the working class. But what does that mean, Rick? A recent report by about 300 economists came to the conclusion that one in seven Americans is in poverty. But it's worse than that. One in five child in this country. And that's a disgrace. We ought to be ashamed of that. 20%, one in five.
And I would argue that those numbers are even
poverty.
Higher.
Yeah, that's right, because there's a lot of hidden poverty. And these are probably figures from, maybe 6 months ago.
Yep.
That's a disgrace.
Businesses,
and that's the real human cost.
I agree. Businesses with rising profits are not hiring workers. You want to know what the class warfare looks like? You're seeing businesses hoarding all this money. You're seeing banks hoarding the money that they were supposed to be loaning out to get this economy moving. You want somebody to be angry about. Be angry at the titans of industry and the captains of the bank who won't give small business people loans so that they can start up and hire people. Because remember, economies snowball. Either you're moving forward or you're moving backwards. They're never stagnant. You want to know what the class warfare looks like? You want to know what a class war looks like? CEOs who lay off more workers, and we've talked about this a couple of times, make 42% higher wages. They take 42% more out of the corporate pot than people who don't lay off workers. So, hey, you laid off a bunch of people. Yeah, way to go. Fill your pockets. Take your $200 and pass go. And they do, again and again and again. And I look at our friend down in Louisiana, the diaper man, Senator Diaper Dan, Diaper Dave Vitter. Well, I'm not the one who allegedly went to a lady that you pay in the evening to put a diaper on, soil myself, and have her clean me up. I'm not the one who did that, supposedly.
It might be past alleged, but
I'm just saying, allegedly, that's what the rumor is. That's what the we'll never know because that woman's dead now. Interesting scenario, Republicans dead hookers. I don't know. Anyway, he represents a state that the average income is about $43,000. But he looked out at an audience and told them that a plan to repeal Bush's big tax cuts for people making more than $250,000 a year would affect virtually everybody in the audience. I got to tell you, I got to be in that audience. If everybody in the audience was making more than $250,000 a year, we need to know those people, because the majority of the people in the state make $43,000 or less. Senator John Kyle, our philanderer from Arizona, I believe.
Yes, he's a...
fighting to protect the tax cuts for the wealthy again. He also fought to block an extension of unemployment benefits. So on one hand, hey, we need to give our rich campaign donors a big, big chunk of windfall pie. But you poor schlubs who lost your job because, well, we cut jobs and we sent them overseas, screw you!
Is this another alleged?
Another what alleged?
You said he was a Flander.
That's alleged. You know, most people, I've read, he's had his problems.
Okay.
From what I've been told. Not me saying it. It's allegedly the point. Also, 55% of adults in the workforce say that since the recession began, they have been unemployed, had their pay cut or their hours reduced, or became involuntarily part-time workers. That's what the class war looks like. And then you got people like former House Majority Leader Tom DeLay and, of course, Republican gubernatorial candidate Tom Corbett.
Oh, okay. I thought you were talking about the senator from Oklahoma.
Nope, the Republican.
Tom Corbett, right, Attorney here. General, Pennsylvania. Thomas.
Saying he, people just don't want to go back to work.
Imagine
they're,
that.
They're fat and happy on unemployment. Mm. They just don't want to go back to work. And, you know, I look at all of these things that they've pointed to over here at Working America. And I say, you know, there is class warfare going on here. It's that most of us in the working class don't realize it. We have been under attack. They have been gunning for us for 30 years. And the only way we can fight back is if we come together. And which is why, again, I give the Tea Party people the credit that they know something's wrong. I'm just concerned that the direction that they want to go is the wrong direction. It's continuing down the same Bush path, the same Reagan path, toward unfettered control by corporations, less control by we the people, more controlled by they the corporations. That concerns me because, you know, I can call my congressman and I can give him a raft of you-know-what that's hip deep, and there's not a thing they can do. They can hang up on me or they can...
Nah, they'll take your name.
Yeah.
And check to see if you registered.
But if I call a private, for-profit corporation who's supposed to be providing me a service and I jump up and down and scream and holler and carry on like you see some of these T-Twizzlers doing, they will walk me out in handcuffs. We're going to take a quick break. We're right back after this with Mark Price, senior labor economist over at the Keystone Research Center. We're right back after this. Stick around.
Don't let us get stupid, all right. Just make us be brave. Make us play nice. Let us be together tonight.
thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. International Association of Machinists members could strike at Cessna Aircraft. The union is urging its members to vote no on a proposed 7-year contract from the company and to authorize a strike. Voting is set for Saturday, just a day before the old contract expires. Machinists District 70 says Cessna wants permanent cuts with no hope of improvement, even in economic good times, for the duration of the 7-year contract. The contract proposal would force union workers to switch to a different health care plan with a 160% increase in premium payments. The health care switch would cost workers an average of $4,000 to $5,000 more per year, according to the union. The machinists represent 2,400 workers at Cessna. The next time you're at your local bank's teller window, SEIU wants you to bring their bank employee whistleblower card with you. That card explains how the Wall Street Reform Law protects bank employees who blow the whistle on predatory and illegal banking practices. SEIU says it consistently hears from bank employees that they're forced to push unsafe and unnecessary financial products on customers. SEIU launched a campaign this week to present the whistleblower cards to bank employees to make sure bank workers are aware of their new rights and protections. For more information on this SEIU campaign, go to action.seiu.org/bankwatch. The RWDSU acceptance of a deal ending the Dr. Pepper Snapple Mott's strike accepted a pay freeze, but not the $1.50 an hour pay cut that the profitable company tried to impose. The union also says the 3-year deal this week ending the 16-week strike does not include a pensions freeze. Newly hired workers, though, will be switched to 401k plans. Most Harley workers in Wisconsin will keep their jobs after grudgingly conceding to concessions this week. The tentative deal includes a pay freeze, hundreds of job cuts, and assigning other work to part-time workers, but it also saves hundreds of jobs. Harley had threatened to move the jobs out of Wisconsin if it didn't get the cuts it wanted. Just 10% of restaurant workers in the United States get health insurance and sick days. Jesse Russell reports.
90% of restaurant workers are not offered health insurance or sick days. That's according to restaurant worker advocacy organization Restaurant Opportunity Centers United. In 2008, the average earnings for workers in the industry were less than $13,000. 2,500 workers were surveyed in 5 cities, and 38% said they are forced to work off the clock. The federal minimum wage for waitstaff has remained at $2.13 per hour since 1991.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. You know, there have been a lot of ideas floated around of how we get people back to work. And I got to tell you, one of my favorite ideas has come from the mega wealthy New York Republican gubernatorial candidate, Carl Paladino, who thinks it would just be the grandest of ideas if we simply transformed some of New York's prisons into work camps for welfare recipients. Wow. Imagine that. Here in Paladino land, the debtor prison guests could dine on the tastiest of bread and lukewarm water while working in state-sponsored jobs. They could get valuable employment training and of course get lessons on personal hygiene. This is the guy's position. He said, you know what? We can put the people back to work. Send them to these prisons. Of course it'd be voluntary, of course. Yes. Do it or starve to death in Paladino land. Wow. Please, wake me up when this is over. Anyway, what we've seen is the census numbers are coming out, and it appears poverty's on the rise. No big surprise there. But I wanted to talk about this a little bit with our friends over at the Keystone Research Center, who've issued their press release talking about the numbers nationwide and here in the state. We've got labor economist Mark Price from the Keystone Research Center here on the line. Mark, welcome to the program.
Hey, Rick. It's very good to be here.
I appreciate you taking time for me. You know, I look at the numbers, and nationally, poverty rose significantly. They're saying 14.5% almost, up from 13.2%. That's a pretty substantial jump.
Yeah, that's 3.7 million new people fall below the Census Bureau's official definition of the poverty line, which was, you know, is something that's, you know, more than 3 or 4 decades old, and it basically asked, you know, what's the bare minimum level of nutritional assistance. So it's not even a very good measure of poverty, but it's the best we've got. And as no one would be surprised listening to your program, given the depth of the decline in the economy, you know, the unemployment rate nationally, it rose 3.5 percentage points between 2008 and 2009. And that's probably one thing I should remind you of is we're really talking about, because of the delay in the collection of this data, we're talking about poverty rates for the year 2009, so which is more than 9 months ago.
So things probably have gotten worse since then.
No, yeah, there's no question that certainly poverty is set to rise when we get the numbers for this current year. So, yeah, it's pretty bad. Here in Pennsylvania, situation isn't quite as bad. You know, our poverty rate was essentially unchanged at about 11% in the most recent two-year period. And, you know, part of what's going on is in the Census Bureau's numbers showed this as well today. There were roughly 3.3 million people who would have been in poverty, would have fallen below the poverty threshold, but for unemployment insurance benefits. If you had taken those out, the poverty rate would have risen even more. And that's certainly true here in Pennsylvania. So, you know, it's one of the things we highlighted in our release is that it certainly benefited Pennsylvania, and maybe to some extent more than it did other places, because our unemployment rate didn't rise as much. So we certainly did get a bit more of a boost from those extensions, which were part of the recovery act.
Right. You know, one of the things that I've said, Mark, on this program quite often, I think we would seriously be in a depression if not for the unemployment, if not for safety net programs that kept the bottom of the employment market from collapsing and smashing into the ground, which some, I think some would want to go back to.
No, absolutely. Certainly people who would like to put folks in workhouses would certainly have advocated for that. And, you know, one of the things that came out of the release nationally today was that not only did poverty go up in the country, but the depth of poverty also went up. There were a lot more people living well below even the official poverty threshold. So it just sort of highlights, you know, this is a very tough labor market for a lot of people, and most especially those that are really at the bottom of the job ladder. You know, they are not only facing competition from each other for jobs, they're now facing competition from people who lost jobs in other sectors and are basically having to resort to take whatever job they can get. And it just sort of makes the queue even longer and puts a lot more pressure on working families. And one number that sort of puts that into perspective for you is the nationally, the unemployment rate for working age individuals, 18 to 64, the poverty rate for that group rose to 12.9%, the highest it's been in 50 years. So, you know, again, it just highlights how deep this recession was. And it would be significantly higher than that, but for, you know, efforts to prop up the economy.
Well, let me ask you this, because, you know, I keep hearing from my teabag friends and from people on the extreme right who have been standing, beating the drum against any stimulus, against any help to the economy, because they believe that there's this invisible hand that's out there guiding the market and this invisible guy behind it pushing all this stuff. Let's say we didn't spend a lot of money to keep people from basic collapse. What do you think our economy would look like today had we not taken action back in the beginning of 2009?
Yeah, well, just to put that number in context, thinking about the unemployment rate, you know, the unemployment rate today in Pennsylvania, we just got a new number, 9.2%. It would be much closer to about 14% right now. So, you know, again, not quite double. But it would be significantly higher, and it would be continuing to rise. You know, and those people that have always been around that have argued that, you know, when an economy collapses, you do nothing. And the last time those people were in power was around 1929, and nothing was done from 1929 into 1930, 1931, 1932. Nothing substantive was done. In fact, in many cases, the wrong things were done. on behalf of the Federal Reserve. They allowed the banking system to collapse, and we got an economy that skyrocketed towards 25% unemployment, and, you know, incredible increases in poverty and many of the other things that, we now recognize are bad. And it really led to a change in people's thinking. You know, when an economy suffers the kind of collapse that we suffered, the most important thing to do was intervene and try to prop up the economy to give it time to recover, give people time to move from jobs that have been lost into new sectors. That was a lesson we learned, and somehow we managed to, you know, forget that lesson a bit. Certainly for a small group of people, you know, they sort of conveniently have forgotten.
Right.
The Great Depression, and maybe in some ways that's easy to do, right? Because most of the people who live through it now are you know, into their old age if they haven't already passed on. So it's sort of collective memory is gone, so it's easier for people to say completely insane things like, you know, let's put everybody in a workhouse.
Or if I were in charge, like, you know, Pat Toomey said, it would have been a much harder down.
Yeah.
I love that mentality. If it were up to me, it would have been a much harder down. But we'd be bouncing back by now.
That's absolutely not true. I mean, one of the key lessons, and we're actually painfully learning it right now, is that economies settle. They settle it at less than full employment. And maybe the best way to think about it is what we're going through right now. We didn't get enough of efforts to help boost the economy in the previous 6 to 12 months. And because we didn't get enough stimulus, a large enough, given the collapse in demand. Because remember, you know, households have suffered about an $8 trillion loss in wealth. And that wealth means a reduction in consumption. People can't spend if they don't have any money.
Right.
And today's income report also sort of highlighted the other problem that we've experienced, that basically households have experienced the lost decade already in the United States, that their incomes today are lower than they were more than 10 years ago.
Well, I give the example all the time, Mark, that my grandmother back in 1985 worked at a Kmart-type store, a small department store. She made $8.50 an hour with full benefits, full dental, a defined benefit pension plan. She had like 6 weeks vacation when she retired. Back in 1985, that was 25 years ago, she made $8.50 an hour. And I got to tell you, I don't think the people at Target and Walmart are making much more than that right now.
Right. No, it's definitely we've gone through a radical change in the sort of the structure of the economy. You know, there was those generations of folks who had very good jobs that paid, you know, really family sustaining wages really that would allow, you know, just one person to go out into the labor force. And really, since about 1980, we've had a dramatic reduction in wages, particularly for men. And that has been accompanied by falls in health insurance coverage, pension coverage, and, you know, people lost jobs in sectors like manufacturing. And it has meant that they get new jobs in, you know, low-wage retail and often that don't come with any of the sort of benefits that one time were hard-earned and won and enjoyed by a lot of people. But that sort of that prototypical opportunity has disappeared for many people in the economy. And as I say that, you know, we do have a pretty healthy and robust middle class, but it's certainly been under a lot of pressure. It certainly hasn't experienced a lot of income growth in
right.
the last 3 decades.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Mark Price, labor economist over at the Keystone Research Center. KeystoneResearch.org is their website. You know, the question then becomes, as we see poverty rising, what do we do about it? Do we go back to where I remember the programs of the Johnson's Great Society and the War on Poverty? I remember programs that helped me, helped people where I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland, because, you know, I grew up in poverty. And it were programs like that helped lift me out of it. So what should we be doing? Should we be looking to the past, or are there some new things that we should be trying?
Well, certainly there are some new things. You know, for instance, here in Pennsylvania, we have a program called The Way to Work, which was funded by a provision in the Recovery Act, and it provides subsidized employment. And I think this really goes to one of the key things about what we now understand about what you do to help people get out of poverty. I mean, most people want to work, and the best thing we can do to help people lift themselves out of poverty is give them a chance to get a job. And the Way to Work program provides a wage subsidy to the employer who agrees to hire a worker from a low-income household or, in some cases, a disadvantaged youth. And those folks, they get a job. They begin to learn the skills of the job. They learn sort of those soft skills of employment. And that experience builds up, and hopefully over time with that accumulation of skill, they're able to move up the income ladder and, you know, not require assistance, not require access to a program that provides them subsidized employment. But that's it's a pretty good program. It just started, and unfortunately, it will expire September 30th unless Congress takes steps to increase its funding for the next year. So, you know, it's a pretty simple way, and it's a good way because, again, you're encouraging folks to go out to get a job, private sector, learn those skills that they need. And, you know, that's certainly one thing that you could do. Something else that would go a long way specifically to help low-income individuals, we have here in Pennsylvania a bill in the House called HB 2400, which is, again, part of the Recovery Act. It's a modernization of the unemployment insurance system that would use, I mean, it's pretty simple. It sounds very strange, but it would just require that when they determine your eligibility for unemployment insurance, they use the most recent quarter, full quarter of earnings in calculating whether you're eligible. This turns out to be a very important change for low-income workers because often they don't qualify to receive benefits because they don't have enough earning.
Right.
And often that's simply because we're stuck in a system that we designed back in the 30s that, you know, took a lot of time to collect data, so we didn't use your most recent quarter. And so these folks don't qualify for unemployment insurance, and that just makes their situation worse and almost really guarantees that somebody that was working lost a job, again, for no reason of their own because they wouldn't qualify for unemployment insurance otherwise. But they lost a job, and they don't qualify for benefit. They make contributions to the system. So there's a very simple reform that would make, roughly somewhere in the order of 20,000 to 30,000 more people eligible for unemployment insurance. That has certainly a benefit for you and me because, again, anybody that's out there spending money, that's generating income in the economy.
And that money is spent almost immediately. I love this argument that's going on in Washington that we need to keep the high end of the Bush tax cuts because those people spend money. You know, the multimillionaires, they're going to spend all of that money. I think that's ridiculous, but that seems to be the argument for keeping the top 2% of the massive tax handouts that we're giving away.
Right. I mean, the reality is, but as you know this, that those top incomes, those folks can't spend. I mean, those incomes are so high that they can't actually spend all the money they earn. And that's exactly what we don't need right now. We don't need people to increase their savings. We got plenty of savings in the economy. What we lack is investment. We lack people spending money. And that's why small businesses and big businesses alike aren't hiring. It's because they just don't have enough demand. They don't have enough customers. And they wouldn't, and they shouldn't, because we've lost so much value in the economy with the collapse of the housing bubble. People, you know, their wages are under pressure. Their incomes are under pressure. They can't borrow against the value of their home anymore, which is what they did in the previous 7 or 8 years. And so households are stuck, and we're going to remain stuck at this sort of less than full employment level for 5-6 years unless we get aggressive behavior on part of the federal government to increase spending in the economy to help put people to work, which generates a paycheck, which generates spending. And again, you know, it's not the high income folks who, by the way, have absorbed most of the benefits of economic growth, not in just the last 5 or 6 years, but really over the past 30.
Right. But Mark,
begs the question, how much is enough?
Yeah, but I'm hearing something here. I'm hearing you talking in glowing terms about redistribution of wealth, it sounds like to me. It sounds like you're one of those people who favors redistributing the wealth.
Well, certainly, I think there's something to be said for making sure that you're raising enough revenue to fund vital services. But I think I would probably emphasize that if we're going to get a society that I'd like to see and that you'd like to see, one that puts the benefits, the wealth that people generate when they work in their paychecks, we need wages to be higher.
Yep.
And you know, that means more bargaining power. That's really how we're going to address rising inequality. Certainly, it's true that, you know, top-income households really have benefited quite a lot from tax policy in the last 7 or 8 years. But anything we could do, and certainly anything that, you know, the Obama administration has proposed, isn't going to fundamentally alter the nature of our society, right? It's not going to lead to, you know, Warren Buffett having no money and living in a box. It's basically, you know, chicken feed to many of these folks.
Well, I mean, it's interesting you bring up Buffett because he's been one of those people who's been saying, hey, tax me. You need to tax me more.
Right.
And you got Greenspan yesterday who came out and said, for the first time in my memory, I'm advocating for a tax increase.
Sure. And, you know, we had much higher tax rates on top income households in that sort of period from 1945 to 73, when incomes grew not just at the top but at the bottom and the middle. And really we had a doubling of living standards throughout the income distribution. Not that that era didn't have its problems, but essentially we had a much more equitable distribution of sort of the wealth that people produce. And again, that comes back to the fact that people had a lot more bargaining power then. And so although taxes are important, really the key is making sure that wages rise when productivity rises.
Well, I mean, I think it's common sense. You put people back to work, they make a reasonable wage, they pay a nice tax. It's a snowballing upward. You have a spiraling up of the economy. What's going on right now is you've got all these companies who see an opportunity to cut wages and to cut employment and to do things that are causing the economy to constrict and to spiral down.
Oh, right.
And if we don't have someone to stop that spiraling down, it will continue.
Right. No, absolutely. You're absolutely right. I mean, it is a vicious cycle very much. Employers, in some sense, they're doing, what's rational given the economic environment. And that's why you need a little bit more countervailing power. You need certainly more spending on the part of government to help boost demand, but you also need, some way to give workers more bargaining power when they sit down with the boss and talk about, what their wage is going to be next year.
Which is why we need labor law reform. I'm looking at some of these. This Mott thing has just gotten me nuts. The fact that it was labeled an economic strike and those people could have been replaced permanently and that would have been the end of it. We absolutely need major labor law reform in this country.
Yeah, I agree.
Mark Price, labor economist at the Keystone Research Center. KeystoneResearch.org is the website. Mark, I appreciate you taking time for me. Keep up the great work over there.
Hey, thank you, Rick. It's a pleasure to be here.
All righty. We're going to take a quick break right here. Right back with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. We're right back at it.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Why do airline executives hate their customers? Not so very long ago, airlines boasted about flying the friendly skies. But that happy slogan has now been perverted into flying the abusive skies. For example, what does a ticket cost? The airlines won't come clean even on this basic question. We do know that stated ticket prices have been steadily rising with double-digit increases in the past year. But that price is merely the starting point for today's airline hucksters. The real gouging is in the frenzy of fees the airlines have invented, many of which are not even disclosed to us, and most of which are simply unwarranted. Last year, airline fees totaled nearly $8 billion, a consumer subsidy siphoned right out of our pockets into the corporate coffers. Take the ticket change fee. If something comes up, forcing you to change a flight from the one you'd booked, you're hit with a service fee of $150. Plus, you must pay the difference if your new flight is priced higher, which it will be. What a ripoff! This rebooking service is done by computer, costing the airline more like $150 rather than $150. Also, notice that airlines themselves routinely cancel or delay flights, forcing us into inconvenient and thoroughly unpleasant travel changes. Yet, they don't pay us $150 for their changes. American Airlines, however, has generously offered to cut its rebooking fee in half if you pay a flexibility fee of $19 when you book your flight. Then, any changes you need to make later will only cost you $75. Yes, it's a fee to reduce your fee. This is Jim Hightower saying, these infuriating fees are unnecessary. Southwest Airlines, for example, refuses to charge for any service that's historically been free to customers, and Southwest is profitable.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book titled, Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, now available wherever books are sold.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
Well, if you're lucky, you'll get 40 hours. At the rate we're seeing people losing their jobs and the rate that we're seeing full-time jobs turning into part-time jobs, tough stuff. But the Republicans, they've got the answer. The Republicans have the answer. South Carolina Senator Jim DeMint told Bloomberg Businessweek, quote, the best thing that could happen for business is complete gridlock in the United States Senate. The best thing that could happen for business is complete gridlock. And as we've been saying all night, look, that's the point. What you do, and it's that's self-fulfilling prophecy, Jake. You say, well, you know, government doesn't work. Government is not responsive to the people. And then you do everything you can possibly do to block it up, to obstruct, to cause gridlock. And then you can point back and say, see, look, we told you. We told you it didn't work. And what amazes me, honestly, what amazes me is that people would vote for a guy who's going to say, I want to represent you in government, but it doesn't work. And I'm obviously not going to be able to make it work. And we're going to destroy it. We're going to drag it in the bathtub, drown it. We vote for these people. I mean, come on. And then we're surprised when we get negative outcomes.
But isn't it amazing, guys like Bobby Jindal and all the conservatives.
Who, Jingle Jangle Jindal?
Jingle Jangle Jingle, who spent his whole political career castigating excessive government and calling for smaller government. But when he wants the government to be there, I don't know, you know, kind of quasi-important things like maybe rescue his state after that BP spill. He wants the government to be there, and if they aren't there and aren't there quickly and do the job, he's the first one, and he was the first one on the air criticizing them.
Yeah, so like we talked about in the last segment with Mark Price, labor economist over at the Keystone Research Center, KeystoneResearch.org, like we were talking about with him, you know, the poverty rate, and you brought it up earlier. The AP has reported the number of people living in poverty has climbed to 14.3% of citizens in this country, with the ranks of the working age poor reaching the highest since 1965. So you go back and you say, look, you know, the policies of Reagan, Bush, to a small extent Clinton, and the little shrub have put us in this situation. The Census Bureau says about 43.6 million people, or one in seven, live in poverty. That's up from 39.8 or 13.2% in 2008. And this crisis has really, really dominated and devastated the people at the margin. And you look at the numbers of people lacking health insurance that rose from 46.3 million to almost 51 million people without health insurance. And again, you know, the way I look at this is it's the failure of the employer-based healthcare system. And I got to tell you, Jake, this report coming out, almost 51 million people without healthcare, a growing percentage. This is an issue that has to be brought up right now, and we're not hearing the Democrats talk about it because, you know what, their plan didn't address it this time around. No real substantial help comes until 2014. And whose fault was that? Well, it was the obstructionists. It was the delay artists. It was the conservative Democrats who joined with the Republicans, people like Max Backdoors. Almost 51 million people without health insurance. And it's because we don't have enough jobs. And stop and think about this for a second. You lose your job. And I've had kids who, you know, I've got three small kids. They're going to have accidents. They're going to fall and they're going to break things and they're going to cut themselves and they're going to get sick and they're going to need health care. You lose your job, you lose your health insurance. Because we live in a pay or die environment. If you don't have health care, you cannot get sustained treatment. So your kid falls, my daughter broke her arm a couple years ago. $12,000. So what the hospital wanted to send me. $12,000. Imagine if you didn't have health care. That could break you. I look at that woman we talked about the other night from San Diego, who the congressman went out there and said, I'll be arrested. You're not taking this woman's home. Her kids got cancer and kidney problems, and they fell behind on their mortgage because of health care bills. And now they're about ready to be homeless, and the kids still got cancer. Kids still got kidney problems.
You know, you recited those numbers, and those are accurate numbers, and that's alarming. But imagine how bad it would have been if we wouldn't have had CHIPS, one, but even more recent, there were special provisions in the Recovery Act, which covered even more. So that $50 million could have been even worse. The problem is, unless we adequately address, and it looks like the economy's leveling off, what does that mean? If you don't have adequate growth in the economy, you're not going to have enough people getting jobs with health care. So as people enter the workforce, if nothing's done economically to accommodate them in adequate jobs, what does that mean? That means even more people without health care.
And again, this is why we have to take the burden of health care off the backs of employers. If they want to compete internationally, I mean, even if you want to take a pro-business approach to health care, if you want to be the most pro-business conservative out there, the one thing that you've got to agree with is health care is killing companies because they cannot compete with countries that provide health care for their citizens. 1-888-520-7425, 1-888-520-RICK. What are your thoughts on this? This healthcare thing for me. Again, we're seeing almost 17% of the people in this country with no healthcare. The largest single year jump from about 15 and a half to almost 17 since they've been tracking this stuff back in 1987. And the thing is you've got, like you said, 1 in 4 children in poverty. The only thing that children seem to have is a little bit of health care because of the CHIP program. About 10% of the kids in this country remain uninsured. And what I find interesting is MSNBC reported the sharpest jumps were in the Midwest and the South. And I go, you know, those are areas that needed health care the most, yet they were the ones who were most vehemently opposed to it. And I'm not quite getting it. You think of the money that we spend on healthcare. I've seen numbers $6,000-$7,000 for every man, woman, and child in this country. Yet we are not covering almost 17% of them, almost 51 million. Where's that money going? And I look at this Pat Toomey ad. And again, it's another one of these things that you go, are you really kidding me? Really? Are you going to put this on the air for people to be influenced by? This is what Pat Toomey decided he was going to run.
Congressman Joe Sestak voted for the most extreme version of the Washington healthcare takeover.
The new healthcare law puts the government between patients and their doctors. It's a prescription for disaster. I tried to discuss safe and effective reform with my Congressman Joe Sestak, but our local group of doctors couldn't even get an appointment. Pat Toomey respects patients' rights. He has the best plan for healthcare.
I'm Pat Toomey, and I approve this message.
And you see the ad. He's sitting on the couch with a big, hunking, thousand-page Bible-type text with his daughter. You know, good light reading. But this woman who she's a doctor, this woman who read the ad, Republican operative. She's been a newcomer to the Republican Party there. She's, trying to make her bones. T. Twizzler, I'll venture to assume. But the one thing that I got to be honest, I know Joe Sestak. I know people that live in his district. The one thing that you cannot say about the man is that you can't get in to meet with him. There's just no way. Every time I've called, I've been able to get through to him. His office has been one of the hardest working congressional offices on the Hill. So when they say that, it right from the beginning it's BS. And beyond that, they say, well, Pat Toomey has the plan. Well, what is it? What is it? Oh, yeah, pay or die. That's why she wants it. Pay or die.
Well, I can tell you why Pat Toomey's running those commercials. I just saw, in fact, I have it in my hand, Rasmussen poll. And it goes into the numbers on the favorability, unfavorability, but it goes into health care. 56% of the voters in this state favor repeal of health care reform. 41%, and this I don't understand, 41% believe that repeal of the Obama health care plan would be a positive for the economy. Now, you're going to have to explain to me, Rick, why are so many people uninformed?
Well, I mean, nothing's actually happened yet. 56%. And again, this is the failure of the Democrats and of the failure of Obama to get out there and push what their plan actually is. There's so much misinformation. And the thought that we were going to push this stuff off to 2014 just makes it even worse. And look, you and I agree, one of the worst things that could happen, and it's not going to happen. They're not going to have the votes to repeal it.
It's all political hyperbole to get elected.
But what's frustrating is you see numbers like this, almost 51 million people. What do we do about that? We were supposed to have a grown-up debate about how we cover everybody. And all we got from the Republicans, all we got from the right, was two-year-old, stick my finger in my ear and roll around on the ground kicking and screaming. That's what we got. And I got to tell you, it's frustrating stuff, because I know a lot of people who don't have health care, and they're worried. So when we come back, we'll pick this up on the other side of the break, because I think this is an important topic. How do we cover everybody? What kind of a system should we have had? 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're right back after this.
I'm a man with a vision. A boy with a gun. I got a picture in my pocket of the lucky one. I'll announce the winner on the radio. With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat. It is my business hat. I'm up till 1 a.m. I must tell you that. I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show. Teaching America for the better.
Hello, I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME, Council 13. The American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. A union of over 1.4 million strong and growing, AFSCME is gaining improvements in the workplace all across America. And right here in the Commonwealth, 95,000 AFSCME members make Pennsylvania happen. Highways, libraries, hospitals, parks, offices, prisons, classrooms, museums, courtrooms. You'll find AFSCME members at work in all these places and many more.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
Today's AFSCME members take on public service jobs as diverse as they are. For more information, please visit our website at AFSCME13.org. Labor is changing. So is your labor union. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happen!
Workers in the 1930s guaranteed right to organize unions. Workers flocked to the labor organization of their choosing to collectively bargain for better wages, hours, and working conditions. Factory, mill, and mine owners, not eager to embrace the changes, fought vehemently to deny workers their rights. As company tactics grew more heavy-handed and brutal, the workers' organizing methods changed. Sit-down strikes became a way for workers to demand their rights and to force management to listen. With a wave of a handkerchief, the tip of a hat, workers would shut down their machines, lay down their hammer, and sit down. Workers at the Hershey Chocolate Factory in Hershey, Pennsylvania, seeking to reduce the 60-hour-long work week, decided to form a union. Initially, an agreement was reached, but as the economy took a downturn, the company willfully violated the agreement by laying off the most senior workers, those who just happened to be the most ardent union supporters. The workers voted to strike the very next day. At 11 a.m. on April 2, 1937, a red handkerchief was waved and the workers began their first sit-down strike in Pennsylvania's history. The company reacted by forming the Loyal Workers Club. These strikebreakers consisted of hired thugs from New York City and local farmers, dairy producers, and shopkeepers who were dependent on the factory. On April 6, Hershey organized a loyalty parade. After hours of rallying speeches, the lathered-up Loyal Workers Club mob found pipes and clubs that had been manufactured at the Hershey planing mill. The angry mob headed to the Hershey factory to throw their strikers out. Songs of solidarity sung by the striking workers could be heard from inside the factory as the angry mob burst into the plant. Blocking the only exit, the Loyal Workers Club, loyal only to management and greed, began pummeling the workers as they tried to escape. The assault left numerous workers bloody and beaten, many unconscious. Within days, Hershey reopened and recognized the renamed version of the Loyal Workers Club. In May of 1938, the National Labor Relations Board ruled Hershey had violated the law and the company union was dissolved. Soon, the workers joined the Bakery and Confectionery Workers Local 464, who have faithfully represented the workers ever since. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Some politicians say the unemployed won't look for work until their benefits run out.
Ed has been laid off from his pipe fitting job for over 18 months.
I'm here to tell you, being out of work is no fun. It sets you back in life. Benefits provide for less than half your wages. There's no health care, and your family suffers. To those politicians who think anybody would rather be collecting unemployment than working, I say come join us. We won't forget on Election Day.
This Labor Day message brought to you by the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO, Richard Bloomingdale President, Frank Snyder, Secretary Treasurer.
Standing tall against the multinational corporate agenda, The Rick Smith Show.
Yeah, I agree. Support the EFCA, the Employee Free Choice Act. You know, there's part of me, Jake, and I look at these numbers, and you know, if we're so bent on the employer-based system, which seems to me to be so very short-sighted, considering only about 55% of the people in this country get their 55.8%. Of the people in this country get their health insurance through their employer. That's down from 58.5%. If we're so bent on this system, we should make employers cover all employees, like Nixon wanted to do back in the 70s. And, you know, there's this fear, and it's really one of the most bizarre things I think we've ever come across in this country, that a third of the country is covered by government insurance. Mainly Medicaid and Medicare. A third, about 93 million people in this country are covered by government insurance. And I got to tell you, most of the people I know who have Medicare are very happy with it. In fact, we saw people marching, "Government, get your hands off my Medicare!" Did you catch that? Because Medicare is a government insurance. You do understand that. But a third of the country, Jake, a third. And now you've got another almost 17% uninsured. Do the math. That's 50% of the country. Why aren't we seeing the 50% of the country who either has government-run insurance or needs it coming together saying, you know what, we want to keep it?
Again, the Democrats haven't done a good job specifying exactly what's in it. Here's another accusation that is so far off the wall. I hear it all the time, Obamacare, it's going to It's going to ruin us. It's too expensive. We can't afford it. But yet, the CBO, which is a nonpartisan wing of Congress, which does analysis of the cost of bills, has come out and said in the first 10 years, we're going to save over $200 billion. In the second 10 years, we're going to save over $2 trillion. But yet, I hear it every day, Obamacare, it's going to wreck us. We can't afford it.
Well, it's because it's what's been drummed into their mind.
Absolutely. Look. At every level. National news, local talk show hosts, they get the same memo.
The question I have for my T-Twizzler friends is, if not this, then what? What's your answer? What's the response? What's the solution? I can tear anything apart. It doesn't take a genius to be able to tear a house down. You have to have a little skill, a little ability to build a house. But it doesn't take a genius to tear anything apart. I can rip anything or anyone to shreds. That's no problem at all. But how do we fix it? How do we get nearly 51 million people the security that they need? And I've said from the beginning, if you want to look at it from a business perspective, we love talking about the small businesses. We just love small businesses. Think about it for a second. If you didn't have to worry about, my kid might fall and break her arm. I can't leave this crummy job. I got to stay right here because there's health care benefits. They're not very good, but they're here. But I'd really like to start my own business. I'd really like to, open that restaurant or start a landscaping business or make widgets in my garage. But I just can't do it because I've got health care concerns. Imagine the entrepreneurial spirit that could be revived in this country if we could take that health care issue off the table and say, look, we're just going to say we're going to save and pay the same money that we've been paying for the last 10 years. We're going to pay the same amount.
Well, and then you have the other issue where you're talking about business with health care. Doesn't matter what size, although the larger and the mid-sized companies tend to compete with foreign competitors, when we're competing, especially with the Europeans, whose health care is paid by their government, we're a distinct advantage. Well, even though our economies are alike in many ways, we're at a distinct disadvantage.
Right.
We are. They're a distinct advantage because, the European employers don't have to worry about the cost of health care. When you talk about it, it drives me crazy that they...
The big argument
is cost too much.
The big argument is, no one's going to tell me.
That's part of it.
The big argument is nobody's going to tell me I have to buy something. Isn't that the basis? Isn't that the basis of the Tom Corbett lawsuit?
When you start talking about health care for all, Rick, right away when you say health care for all, what's the first word out? Well, we don't want socialized medicine. And then they say, well, it's in Canada. I said, no. Canada, they don't really understand the full explanation of socialized medicine. Canada does not have socialized medicine. There's only three countries in the world that do. But the point is, when you start talking about health care for all right away, the connotation is socialism and big government programs that are ineffective. And here's another thing. They talk about Canada. Oh, it doesn't work. We don't want the English system. Oh, really? Have you talked to people from over there? It works, and it works fine, and the vast number of people in both those countries are perfectly fine with their system.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. What are your thoughts on the health care dilemma? I keep hearing my tea friends saying, well, nobody's going to tell me what I have to buy. Nobody's going to mandate me. And my question back is why should I have to pay for a free rider? Why should I have to pay for someone who chooses to gamble? Because we know that, if someone who does this, who chooses to be a free rider, who chooses to live like a parasite off the system, we know that when they get sick, they're going to go to the doctor. And we know that we're going to have to pay for it. And they're going to go in the most expensive mode possible. I'm of the mindset, look, let's set up a system where people have the ability to go to the doctor. When you get a cold, when you get sick, you get a yearly physical, Hey, stay up on top of this stuff. Personal responsibility. Now, why is it that we can't have people to have responsibility to ensure that they're protected? We make people who drive cars have car insurance. How come I don't hear people complaining about that? Well, you could walk. Well, sure you can. But you're not out on the road driving. Good luck getting anywhere or getting to work. Most people have to drive. And if you drive, you have to have insurance. And I'm saying, if you live in this country and you expect to use health care, you better have a way of paying for it. And we as a society have to figure out how to get that taken care of.
We're talking about some of the minutia, but at the end of the day, this goes back to that whole discussion and where the Democrats and Obama screwed up. They allowed the opponents to dictate the perception to the American people. But at the end of the day, it's a simple concept. It's a simple concept. It's better for this country when everyone has health care.
Well, at the end,
and then enumerate a few talking points, because if you get bogged down, people are going to talk about abortion, they're going to talk about undocumented workers.
These are
everything
who didn't
that takes
the
discussion off the center of the discussion.
These are people who did not
Absolutely.
Want it from the
Absolutely.
Beginning.
Absolutely. Right.
And they're going to do everything that they can do to hold it up, to destroy it, and to water it down, to poison pill it, which is what where we are right now. And I got to be honest, this is where I blame Obama.
Absolutely.
He should have been more diligent. And
from day one,
part of me says the biggest mistake was thinking the American people were grown up enough to watch the legislative process on TV.
Well, not only that, the biggest mistake was giving seating to me. He was in a great situation. He came off this just tremendous outpouring of support for this president and hope. It's a little bit like George Bush in the United States after we were attacked. We had the goodwill of the nation, and so it was on this issue with President Obama. He had so many things going for him, and he should have said, Congress, I not only want health care, this is what I want, A, B, C, and D. Instead, what did he do, Rick? He said, I want health care reform, now you get it. He started with a compromise by ceding the power to Congress. He started off wrong, and we went from one compromise to another compromise to another compromise, and now we have what we have, a watered-down bill.
And I'm not happy with it. And I wasn't happy with it from the beginning. And we are now going to have this fight, this gridlock over the bill. And it's frustrating. Anyway, today, State House Labor Relations Committee held a public hearing up in Scranton to hear from different groups and industry experts about workplace safety issues and the potential for job creation in the Marcellus Shale natural gas drilling industry. Committee member State Representative Kevin Murphy, a Democrat from Lackawanna County, says a balance must be struck between the economic development potential of the burgeoning industry and worker safety. And I would add, actually having Pennsylvania workers, because we are sitting on an absolute gold mine. The problem is, how dirty are we going to getting that gold? How bad are we going to pollute our environment? How bad are we going to screw things up? And I'm glad to hear that they're holding these hearings. We had a caller on our weekend show who said, why don't we just invest in drilling the natural gas ourselves and have the state keep the profits? Kick all these companies out, do it ourselves. It's our natural gas.
We'd be called the People's Republic.
Well, you know what? It's our
natural gas. I don't have a problem with it, but try to get it politically.
It is our natural gas.
Absolutely.
And, at some point, we have got to reap that benefit back. You know, in the good socialist state of Alaska, where K. Sarah Palin quit and made her fortune in TV, they actually hand out checks to all the citizens every year from the oil that's extracted from the ground. That doesn't sound to me like a good free market, pro-business approach, but it's a smart thing. It keeps your local economy boosted. It helps pay for roads and schools and all the things that are important. And I think this natural gas has to be one of the pieces of the pie that solves our budget crisis, that makes sure that we have state-of-the-art education and an infrastructure that is of the 21st century. That means That means high-speed rail. That means rebuilding roads and bridges. That means public transportation. And all of it together. What we've got to stop allowing to happen, Jake, is we've got to stop being divided on transportation. It has to be one thing. We have to have an overall plan for the entire state for our transportation needs. Because for too long, what we've allowed to happen is anytime you talk about public transportation, you go, oh, that's Philly or Pittsburgh, and that's those people. And we've divided ourselves. And I like the fact that, you know, State Rep Dwight Evans, who we're going to probably talk to tomorrow, has introduced a bill that would raise $1.3 billion for transportation. I understand it's not quite as much as we're going to need, but it's a start. Now, here's the thing. I really don't think it's going to pass before the election. But there's got to be the start of the discussion. How do we get this money into the hands of the contractors to hire the people to do the work? That's how we're going to get out of this economic situation we're in, putting people back to work.
Well, that plus, if I can for a second go back to Marcellus here, who becomes governor? Make no mistake, it's going to have a dramatic impact on how we handle the Marcellus Shale. We have a real possibility of a gold mine, a real gold mine. But the next governor is going to oversee a situation where, first of all, should we be going as fast? Should we be issuing these permits as fast? Are we holding these companies accountable? That's the first question. And the second question is, once we give them permits, what's the tax structure? We have to make sure we have adequate taxes from them, because it's not just about the state making money. It's about recovering some of the cost. And make no mistake, we're going to have to add some people in the Department of Environmental Resources in Pennsylvania. And that cost should be borne by the industry who is making big profits. And then we come to the third question. And I've heard Honorado talk about it. I haven't heard a peep out of Corbett. How do we, by law or by pressure from the governor or from the state government, how do we ensure that as many of those jobs that are created out there are being given to Pennsylvanians? How do we ensure that? You have to have a governor who has that as a priority. I haven't heard a peep out of Corbett.
Well, we haven't heard a peep out of Corbett on anything because he doesn't have to. We're not asking him any questions. Every time he does open his mouth, he sticks his foot in it. But here's the reality. He doesn't have to, because the extreme right, the T-Twizzlers, they don't ask any questions. They don't care. He's our guy. The T-Twizzlers said he's okay. So we're going to vote for him, just like this woman in Delaware. I mean, come on. This woman is off the reservation. They should be sending people with white coats after her.
It can only happen in America right now. Only now. I mean, someone like this would have been laughed. The people would have laughed at her. 10 years ago, not a thought would have been given to someone like this. Not a thought. I mean, if someone like this would have come forward, either party, and even a third party would have said, no, I don't think so.
Yeah, you brought up the Department of Environmental Protection. And the next governor, whoever that is going to be, and right now it's looking like Subpoena Tom. it's looking like him. Can you imagine what's going to happen when you appoint someone who doesn't believe that they should be protecting the environment, that they should be a pro-business person? You know, maybe someone who Tom Ridge suggested would be a good Department of Environmental Protection head. Can you imagine that? Is that going to be good?
Who's working for the industry?
Who's working for the industry?
Oh, isn't that dandy? Can you say incestuous?
And for a while, we're going to think everything's just wonderful and peachy keen and beautiful. Until we're left with, you know, look at the coal industry. Hmm. Look at the remnants that are left behind of that. Look at the devastation.
And yet with a straight face, the Republicans are saying, oh, we don't want to tax them. We don't want to tax them. They're gonna run away.
They won't come.
They're gonna run away. Oh, please, come on, let's get real. There's fortunes to be made. There's huge fortunes to be made. Some people believe, and that could very well be true. I happen to believe it. It's the largest find of natural gas in the world, folks.
They'll come. We're going to take a quick break. We're right back after this with your calls. 1-888-520-1110. Rick, 1-888-520-7425. We're right back.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. International Association of Machinists members could strike at Cessna Aircraft. The union is urging its members to vote no on a proposed 7-year contract from the company and to authorize a strike. Voting is set for Saturday, just a day before the old contract expires. Machinists District 70 says Cessna wants permanent cuts, with no hope of improvement, even in economic good times, for the duration of the 7-year contract. The contract proposal would force union workers to switch to a different health care plan with a 160% increase in premium payments. The health care switch would cost workers an average of $4,000 to $5,000 more per year, according to the union. The machinists represent 2,400 workers at Cessna. The next time you're at your local bank's teller window, SEIU wants you to bring their bank employee whistleblower card with you. That card explains how the Wall Street Reform Law protects bank employees who blow the whistle on predatory and illegal banking practices. SEIU says it consistently hears from bank employees that they're forced to push unsafe and unnecessary financial products on customers. SEIU launched a campaign this week to present the whistleblower cards to bank employees to make sure bank workers are aware of their new rights and protections. For more information on this SEIU campaign, go to action.seiu.org/bankwatch. The RWDSU acceptance of a deal ending the Dr. Pepper Snapple Mott's strike accepted a pay freeze, but not the $1.50 an hour pay cut that the profitable company tried to impose. The union also says the 3-year deal this week ending the 16-week strike does not include a pensions freeze. Newly hired workers, though, will be switched to 401k plans. Most Harley workers in Wisconsin will keep their jobs after grudgingly conceding to concessions this week. The tentative deal includes a pay freeze, hundreds of job cuts, and assigning other work to part-time workers, but it also saves hundreds of jobs. Harley had threatened to move the jobs out of Wisconsin if it didn't get the cuts it wanted. Just 10% of restaurant workers in the United States get health insurance and sick days. Jesse Russell reports.
90% of restaurant workers are not offered health insurance or sick days. That's according to restaurant worker advocacy organization Restaurant Opportunity Centers United. In 2008, the average earnings for workers in the industry were less than $13,000. 2,500 workers were surveyed in 5 cities, and 38% said they are forced to work off the clock. The federal minimum wage for wait staff has remained at $2.13 per hour since 1991.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit Labor Radio.
Making the blue blood see red.
The Rick Smith Show.
Yes. People from the... They are watching you. They are watching you. They are over your shoulder.
We have our ways.
Yes, we have our ways, and we will find you. Are you buying this that the governor didn't know? Are you buying it?
No. It's hard for me to believe. Well, let me put it to you this way. Somebody very close to him, I'm sure, did. And there ought to be heads rolling. Absolutely rolling.
Yeah, I got to be honest. I'm leery when government starts watching people and reporting back to the private corporations. I'm a little leery on that. I feel a little uneasy, especially when you're bringing the private corporation into the mix. That kind of bothers me.
I mean, you talk about run amok. They were actually spying on groups who were supporting some of the programs of the governor. I mean, how crazy is that?
Well, I think we had this discussion already.
We did.
What I think happened, they sent these PIs out to follow people, and they ended up going from group to group. And, you know, when you start, You know, start following people. You start writing down their activities. You, who knows where you end up? And I think some of that was part of it. I do. This Washington Post story caught my eye, and it's one of those things where you go, the cost of moving forward, the cost of being energy efficient has cost about 200 people their job. The last major GE factory making ordinary incandescent light bulbs in the United States is closing this month, marking a small, sad exit for a product and company that can trace their roots to Thomas Alva Edison's innovation in 1870. The remaining 200 workers at the plant will lose their job. You know, who I blame for this is not the workers. The company could have easily changed those manufacturing lines, could have invested in that workplace. And what they decided to do, you know, they decided China was the place to go. And these CFLs that you know, now pretty much are going to be mandatory, the little curly Qs, they're all made in China. And I had a friend of mine tell me that, I think it's Sylvania, that makes a light bulb almost, you know, it looks like a real light bulb, like a regular light bulb that we've been accustomed to, not those little curly Q, you know, not the little curly fry things, but a regular light bulb that they make here in the U.S. It's a little bit more expensive, but it doesn't have mercury in it, like the little curly Qs do. And that the company wasn't marketing it because they make much more money off the little curly Q things made in China with the mercury. Again, you know, you stop and you think about this stuff and you go, these are the companies that I want policing themselves when you had you have a product that's pretty safe, yet the other one's a little more profitable. So we're going to fill our environment with mercury so that they can have a little more profit.
And they're both energy efficient, I assume.
Yeah, I mean, the little curly Q ones, they're fairly energy efficient, but these new ones that they've come up with don't have the mercury, and they actually look like real light bulbs. But they've decided, you know what? The other ones are more profitable. And here again, you know, when we start talking about business, I'm all in favor of businesses making a profit. You know, I had someone say to me today, well, you know, what's wrong with businesses making a profit? I go, nothing. I want businesses to be incredibly profitable. I want them to run their operation efficiently and productively, and I want their workers to work hard and to make the product and be proud of what they do so that they can take more home in wages and a larger portion of the pie. Everybody's happy that way. But when you add in places like China and Malaysia and India and all of these places that allow U.S. companies to come and build their factories and rape the environment and exploit the workforce, what do you expect? What do you expect? Did you see the story today in the Patriot that the world's second largest airplane landed in Harrisburg International Airport? It's this Antonov, A-N-T-O-N-O-V.
Russian.
The second largest plane, I guess. They carry heavy equipment. They've come to the area to take some big cranes and some big lifts. The rumor is to Afghanistan to build something there. And my question is, why are we moving that stuff over there when we got so many things we need to build here? You know, why are we stimulating the Afghani economy? Why are we stimulating the Russian economy? Why aren't we doing that here? Why are we building stuff at home?
Isn't there an American plane that could transport? Apparently
no,
not.
No, evidently, according to this article, nope. They took four JLG Skylifts and an 80-ton Grove crane upon the AN-124-100. The process took 2 hours, according to the news report. So, that, you know, they're loading this, and this is a behemoth plane. I mean, I'm looking at pictures of it, and I'm going, how in the name of anything does that thing get off the ground? Because I've seen some of the C-4, some of those really big
cargo
planes that the Army has up in Springfield, Massachusetts, or up there off 84, near Maybrook, New York. I can't remember what the name of that base is up there. But you see these flying behemoths where the sky just goes dark and the ground shakes. And I'm looking at this thing going, wow, That is massive. But what they're doing is they're taking, you know, taking these big lifts and these big, this big crane to go do something. I wish they would do something here. And I wish our friends on the extreme right would allow that to happen, Jake. Did you see the big news? U.S. homes lost to foreclosure up 25%, according to the Associated Press. Lenders took back more homes in August than in any month since the start of the mortgage crisis. Because more people are losing their benefits, more people are losing jobs, they've burnt up all their retirement, they've burnt up all their savings, there's nothing left. And when we start talking about stimulus packages, getting people back to work, elasticity programs, keeping people in their homes, again, you know, the Republicans, the right, they don't want any part of it. They want the economy to collapse, a hard down, as Pat Toomey said. It's worrisome. You know, I look at me. I'm in my house. It's not worth what it was. Most of us are in that boat because the jobs aren't here. So the question is, how do we have the grown-up discussion? How do we have the debate on how to bring that back? How do we have an economy that works for all of us? That's the question. And what, you know, what they're saying is you're looking at another 3 years in excess inventories because you've got a bunch of people who are retiring, a bunch of people who are struggling to get by, putting their homes up on the market. And they're talking about as many as 12 million new properties coming onto the market in the next 3 years. And, you know, according to Moody's Analytics Incorporated, Fannie Mae, Morgan Stanley, and Barclay, they're talking about the shadow inventory, the supply of homes in default or foreclosure that may be offered for sale is preventing prices from bottoming out after a 28% plunge. Since 2006, almost a third of the value of your home gone. I mean, that is scary stuff, Jake. Because, you know, we were told, you know, there was the great ownership society. Remember during the Bush years? Well, we're living in the ownership society. You know, the owner, you're going to own your home, and you're going to it's always going to go up in value, and you're going to be wealthy. It didn't work out so well.
In 1 month, just to amplify what you said, just in this state, in 1 month, there were 6,500 foreclosure notices that went out to Pennsylvanians. 6,500. That's huge. It's actually a five-year high in August. So things are not getting better in Pennsylvania, unfortunately.
But, you know, in Republican world, there's opportunity there. Because we can go in and snatch up those foreclosed homes and kick those people out to the curb, and we can turn a nice, tidy profit. We can flip the house. I love Republican world. 1-888-520-7425. 1-888-520-RICK. What are your thoughts on this? What should we be doing? How do you do this? How do you stop people from losing their homes? Look, I'm somebody who's looking around my neighborhood, and I live in a pretty good neighborhood, going, there's like four or five properties for sale. And the values aren't what they were 2-3 years ago. That means the value of my home's going down. And the more properties that go up for sale, the lower your value goes. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you want to go to the whole free market thing, that's supply and demand, folks.
I had a friend. Well, I still have a friend in my township, right on the main square, a beautiful home. She's had it on the market for about a year, and no bites.
You know, you look at all of these foreclosures. Look at all of these foreclosures. Were all of these people irresponsible? I mean, that's what we hear from the right. They took on loans that they couldn't afford to pay back. Well, they could afford to pay it when they had a job. Were all these people irresponsible, Jake? I mean, here we are, 2 years after the Bush Depression. 2 years. We're still seeing the effects of that massive recession. We bailed out the banks, man. They're fat and happy now. Happy times on Wall Street.
It's the economy. It's also the cost of health care in too many instances. It's just a perfect storm. And that's that is the American dream, owning your own home, and millions of Americans in the last couple of years have lost that dream.
I can't tell you how just devastated I would be. And I can't imagine what these people are going through. I mean, that was your home. That's what you put all your hopes and your dreams in. That's where your family was. And to have it taken away. I go back to that story this past week we talked about in San Diego. The child had cancer, had kidney problems. They're losing their home because they couldn't pay the medical bills and the mortgage. So I can't imagine. Think about that for a minute. You can't help your child, and you can't stop them from taking your home. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. We'll be right back.
Been on welfare, and that's one place I won't be. I'll be working as long as my two hands are fit to use. I'll drink my beer in a tavern, sing a little bit of these working men.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
Why do airline executives hate their customers? Not so very long ago, airlines boasted about flying the friendly skies. But that happy slogan has now been perverted into flying the abusive skies. For example, what does a ticket cost? The airlines won't come clean even on this basic question. We do know that stated ticket prices have been steadily rising with double-digit increases in the past year. But that price is merely the starting point for today's airline hucksters. The real gouging is in the frenzy of fees the airlines have invented, many of which are not even disclosed to us, and most of which are simply unwarranted. Last year, airline fees totaled nearly $8 billion, a consumer subsidy siphoned right out of our pockets into the corporate coffers. Take the ticket change fee. If something comes up, forcing you to change a flight from the one you'd booked, you're hit with a service fee of $150. Plus, you must pay the difference if your new flight is priced higher, which it will be. What a ripoff! This rebooking service is done by computer, costing the airline more like $150 rather than $150. Also, notice that airlines themselves routinely cancel or delay flights, forcing us into inconvenient and thoroughly unpleasant travel changes. Yet, they don't pay us $150 for their changes. American Airlines, however, has generously offered to cut its rebooking fee in half if you pay a flexibility fee of $19 when you book your flight. Then, any changes you need to make later will only cost you $75. Yes, it's a fee to reduce your fee. This is Jim Hightower saying, these infuriating fees are unnecessary. Southwest Airlines, for example, refuses to charge for any service that's historically been free to customers, and Southwest is profitable.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book titled, Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, now available wherever books are sold.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
I got 800 miles of open border right outside my door. There's Minutemen in little pickup trucks who declared their own dang war. Now the government wants to build a barrier like old Berlin, 8 feet tall. But if Uncle Sam sends the illegals home, who's gonna build the wall? Who's gonna build your wall, boy? Who's gonna mow your lawn? Who's gonna cook your Mexican food when your Mexican maid is gone?
I was never a big Mexican fan, Mexican food fan, to be honest.
You haven't tasted fried ice cream, Rick.
Is that like a deep-fried Twinkie?
You'll have to try it and make your own assumptions.
That's all right. I'll pass. Thanks. I appreciate the offer, though. Thanks anyway. Today over at the Capitol, Dan Honorato was was there. He had a press conference, and a number of reporters and a couple of people showed up, and I went over to listen to, you know, to what he had to say, and picked up one of his press releases. And, you know, some of the things that he touts, good stuff. You know, he said he reduced the size of government to save taxpayers $31 million a year. Isn't that usually a Republican talking point? He held down the annual increases of the Allegheny County General Fund by an average of 1.7 per year, he says. The budget for Honorado's own office has never increased since he was since he had been Allegheny County executive, and according to his release, he cut the number of take-home cars in county agencies under his control by 10%. You know, I love that. You know, Corbett made an issue out of the number of state vehicles that are out there, yet his office had an increase.
I saw that.
And, you know, he talked about budgets. He's never really had a budget. And he's poking at Honorado, who actually has a pretty good record. I mean, as far as, you know, look, he's a centrist Democrat. He is what he is. He's no flaming lefty. He's a middle, right? He's a fairway Democrat, right down the middle. And, you know, he's attractive to fiscally responsible conservatives.
He's the kind of Democrat can win in this state.
Right. You know, but you look at Corbett, who, you know, and he points out the fact that Corbett has asked for spending increases every year that he's been in office. And I find it interesting that when asked about some of the programs that Corbett would cut, he couldn't name one that he would cut. And I find that pretty interesting. What it tells me is he's about an inch deep. He's a very good attorney general, I guess. You know, he goes after and he prosecutes criminals, I guess. He said he mocked the Department of Community and Economic Development for having over 300 programs, yet he couldn't identify any that were wasteful, revealing to an audience of Pennsylvania mayors that, quote, "I can't tell you right now that we are funding programs that aren't working." I mean, think about that for a second. He's going, this is the guy who's running for governor. I mean, if you're running on the platform that, well, government's wasteful and there are all these programs out there that are bad, don't you think you'd have one, maybe two? Don't you think? I mean, because the conservatives are like, oh, Department of Education, Department of Energy, and they spew them off. You know, they spew them off. Boom, 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 boom. They don't know what those agencies do. They can't tell you specifically what it is they don't like about them most of the time. But it's a nice talking point. And he doesn't even have that, Jake. Doesn't even have that.
Well, he also tried to justify it by saying, well, you know, I have more oversight responsibility and jobs getting bigger.
I also love the statement that he goes, well, my office brings money into the state. That's your job. Your job is to go after tax cheats. That money would have been taxpayer money anyway. You should be doing your job.
But on the other hand, he acted like it wasn't a big responsibility to be fiscally responsible for the state's money. So he's been a bit hypocritical on that. And to run as a fiscal conservative is a stretch.
You know what worries me, and I got to be honest, I'm really worried about the fact that we conceivably could have Tom Corbett as governor and Pat Toomey as senator, and we will not know anything about them until they're in office. Because I'm just not seeing any good reporting, anything that is going to tell you about these guys. And nobody's asking them the tough questions. And they're not answering them. I mean, is this what Bush brought us? You know, I'll ask you a question, Jake. Like, you know, let me ask you about chocolate. When you mix the chocolate, what concentration do you use of who knows what? And then Jake would go, well, you know, I think the Eagles are going to have a good team this year, and ticket prices are all right. And what's that got to do with chocolate? Just about what these guys talk about politics. Why do we put up with it? Why do we allow them to get away with it? And yet we still have people willing to vote for them.
And does anybody know his policy on property tax reform, which is big. How about his solutions? Here's a biggie he's going to have to face. How about his solutions with this huge deficit facing the state? What are his proposals? Have you heard? I haven't heard one peep out of him.
I have. No tax increases.
Well, that's silly. I mean, come on. I mean, does he really believe in this environment that he's going to get away? He would have to cut so many. I'm going to say it. The chances of that happening are very slim. Very slim. He's going to have to raise taxes. I don't care what he says. Of course, once he's elected governor, if he is, he can then say, well, I had to. And that's probably what will happen.
That will not work. And
if he's going to do it, he needs to do it early.
I think he's dangerous enough not to do it. I think he's ideologically driven enough that he would not do it because you'll learn the lesson from H.W. Bush.
Well, but on the other hand, if you're going to, the political axiom is, Rick, if you're going to do something that's unpopular, do it early in your term. So that people, and the truth is, people do have short memories. Here's the thing, you mockingly said about George Bush and Honey Made Chocolate. I saw him in PCN. What's he doing? I actually think he did. I think I did see him. He went through a candy company. You laugh. Well, when you're doing that, you don't have to answer the tough questions.
Oh, man. What have we done?
Well, I mean, let's be honest. Everybody knows him as they said, oh, I like him. He went after the criminals. Well, did he? Yeah, and he was selective. And you can say he did a good job. I'm very leery of someone who is willing to use all the resources of the state to basically get elected. You know it, and I know it. And that's
Twitter Tom wouldn't misuse.
Oh, please.
Twitter Tom wouldn't misuse.
Oh, please. That's
his
famous. Everybody knows him for that. And he's pretty popular right now. And Honorado's going to have to come on hard in the next 6 weeks to beat him. I'm not saying he couldn't. But right now, a lot of people like him.
I think the debates will be something that we need to look seriously at.
Well,
and there's one scheduled for September 27th.
Yeah, one. But Honorado wanted like 14 of them.
Well, of course, if you're behind, you're going to want more debates. Or if you're crazy like the woman in Nevada, you're not going to want any. Because, people will then see that you're crazy.
Well, it used to be kind of a standard thing in this state, Rick, where at least one of the debates was televised statewide.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. I loved, the idea of Lincoln-Douglas-type debates, where you just stand there and none of this, I want 20,000 pages worth of rules, and, you can't ask me a question directly. I want people screaming at each other. I want to get to the bottom of it. I want answers. I want the truth. And even though Jack Nicholson says I can't handle the truth, I think I can.
I can buy that. Well, I mean, right off the bat, when you realize that this whole ballyhooed investigation, I believe he's the first attorney general in a similar situation not to call in U.S. attorney, and he should have. He should have recused himself for obvious political conflict of interest.
Especially running for governor.
But yet, when have you heard it? I heard some talk. To be honest, my local talk show host, I disagree with her on a lot of things, but she did bring it up, and she said she has a problem with that, and good for her. And she tends to be a libertarian.
I think she's right on.
She's right on, but yet, where's the criticism? This man's going to be, he's going to be governor, he has a good shot at being governor of the state. Why aren't they questioning him on that? That's basic integrity. I mean, this man, he throws around the state power like nobody's business. That's troubling.
Yeah, I look at these budget increases, though, of Corbett's office. And, 2005, he wanted almost 10%. 2006, almost 5%. 2007, almost 6%. 2008, almost 4%. 2009, right around 5.5%. 2010, 13%. So you go, wow, you can't live within your budget? And, what amazes me is that, people think that the Republicans are the fiscally responsible ones. Stop and think of who got us into this mess, folks. When I joke that, people spend like a Republican, that's an earned statement. You look at all the money that's been wasted over the years on big tax cuts for the very wealthy. You know, when Bush took office, there was over a $5 trillion surplus. When he left office, over a $5 trillion deficit.
You can go back to Reagan. Not as much, but the same scenario.
Let's not. I prefer not.
My point is, he touted himself as his arch conservative, yet he doubled the size of government.
And left
us with a nice, fat debt.
Yeah. Let's take a quick break. Now's a good time for a break. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. We're right back after this. Stick around.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Some politicians say the unemployed won't look for work until their benefits run out.
Ed has been laid off from his pipe fitting job for over 18 months.
I'm here to tell you, being out of work is no fun. It sets you back in life. Benefits provide for less than half your wages. There's no health care, and your family suffers. To those politicians who think anybody would rather be collecting unemployment than working, I say come join us. We won't forget on Election Day.
This Labor Day message brought to you by the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO, Richard Bloomingdale President, Frank Snyder, Secretary Treasurer.
Hello, I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME, Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. A union of over 1.4 million strong and growing, AFSCME is gaining improvements in the workplace all across America. And right here in the Commonwealth, more than 95,000 AFSCME members make Pennsylvania happen. Highways, libraries, hospitals, parks, offices, prisons, classrooms, museums, courtrooms. You'll find AFSCME members at work in all these places and many more.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
Today's AFSCME members take on public service jobs as diverse as they are. Not for the recognition, but for a better Pennsylvania. For more information, please visit our website at AFSCME13.org. Labor is changing. So is your labor union. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happen!
Time for change. It's time to rearrange.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell me.
I agree. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. What's on your mind? What do you think tonight? You know, I look at the fact that Harrisburg City Schools are talking about cutting pre-K and full daycare programs, cutting sports programs. And it's frustrating because we know that pre-K and kindergarten programs help give kids a good, solid foundation as they move into their academic career. And we also know that sports programs keep at-risk kids in school, which is important. And what I've been seeing lately, and it's distressing to me on a number of levels, is this two-tier education system that seems to be propping up. And you've got this, it really came to me the other day, Jake. My 4-year-old, we wanted to get him involved in some kind of sports activity. He wanted to try soccer. So we looked around, and the only thing we could find is some 5-week, $72 program. They'll have him run around in a circle. And what it made me realize is the programs that were there when I was a kid that brought people, kids together to learn to play sports and to learn to be citizens, really, are gone. And they've been taken over and co-opted by for-profit entities, be it religious, be it private, whatever you want to call it. And what we're seeing is the destruction, in my opinion, the destruction of public education. And I'm frustrated by that because, you know, as someone who grew up in a housing project and was able to dig out of that, I worry that the generations behind me are not going to have that opportunity. Because education is that way out. When you have an education, when you can think critically and you can solve problems, I don't think you're going to be hungry. I think you will find ways to be resourceful. And what frightens me is that we're creating an environment, like by doing this kind of stuff, cutting good, solid programs that are proven in poor areas. What we're doing is we're creating that gulf between those who have and those who do not.
Well, I think your upbringing in Harrisburg City, in many ways, are pretty similar. I don't think people realize that don't live in this area. There's some pretty abject poverty in Harrisburg now. You might have to look a little bit more than in Philly and New York, but it's there. My point is this. When you're talking about eliminating totally for a whole year sports programs?
I think they're talking about indefinitely.
Well, that would be a moratorium is what it would amount to. They would eliminate them for a while, but first of all, I don't think that'll happen. I think sports is too popular. It's too important. Second of all, because of the economic upbringing of a lot of these kids, the only way out of here, and Harrisburg has had some superior basketball teams. They won state titles. In basketball and football, which are the two big sports, you know, Harrisburg has probably had in the last 10 years as many athletes make it to college. And let's be honest, some of them kids, that's the only way they were going to make it because their parents simply did not have the money. So when you deny that, not only are you denying them maybe a lifeline to a better life, I think sports in general, and I'm one who's a strong advocate because I played and you played, and I truly do believe that sports does teach life lessons. It's not just kids going around and keep staying in shape because, I mean, when we were kids, we stayed in shape. We do need that, but it's more than that. You know, these kids don't go out for sports just to stay in shape. They do it for various reasons, you know, school spirit, the whole thing. But at the end of the day, it does teach. When you get dedicated and you want to be really good for the average athlete, now there's superior athletes that maybe don't have to quite be as dedicated, but if you want to really be dedicated and good at it, it teaches life lessons. It teaches you how to work together, teaches you hard work, it teaches you how to work for a common goal, all these things that you're going to lose. I can honestly tell you, I've always been one that had a lot of self-discipline. That came from sports. I mean, I had good coaches. The stories that you tell me, you had good coaches. If you wanted to play football, you did it the coach's way, didn't you? You didn't have any choice. Did that teach you a lesson? I believe it did. I mean, you said, and maybe even if you wouldn't have played football, you would have been a hard worker. But I know some of my personal habits have been forged from playing sports. I think it's an integral part of education is what I'm saying. And especially when on top of that, you deny kids whose maybe only lifeline to a better life is to get a college education through sports. I think that's unacceptable.
Well, throughout the years, I think we've all known a couple people who, had it not been for, you know, playing a sport, would have left school and would not have graduated and would not have stuck it out. And then, you know, you find them years later and they're successful because they did finish high school and maybe went on to some college. Because we know the statistics are there. If you do not finish high school, you are at a severe disadvantage. And in this economy, you know, I think a lot of workers are at a disadvantage. But really, if you're at the minimum not a high school graduate.
Oh, absolutely. Companies today, I mean, companies today at any kind of position at all, they want a college, a minimum, just a basic college degree. And in many of the jobs, they want masters.
There you go. President Obama will appoint Elizabeth Warren, from what I understand, to a special advisory role to help lead a new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, quote, while avoiding a potentially vicious confirmation fight. in her new role as advisor to President Obama and Treasury Secretary Geithner. Warren will take charge of the new watchdog agency she personally proposed 3 years ago to protect Americans against lending abuses. And, you know, you look at some of these foreclosures, Jake, and the numbers are, wow. You can't say that everybody was irresponsible and everybody was stupid. This was an industry based on how can we set this up that we win. I remember when I sold my house back in 2004, right at the height of the market. The kid that bought my house, you know, paid way more than it was worth, in my opinion, and ended up getting a sizable mortgage. And his belief was, you know, it was never going to end. The value was going to keep growing because the market was booming and everything was going to keep piling on. And that didn't work out. And what we saw is the market come crashing down.
Was he able to hold on to his house?
Yeah, but he's struggling to make ends meet. And the reality is he's got a family structure behind him who's, you know, his parent, from what I understand, his parents are kicking up to, you know, to help him keep it. But, you know, most people don't have that luxury. Most people are at the margin. I know when I bought my first house, you know, we were able to, you know, put the 20% down, but making those payments every month was, you know, you had to make them. You had to go to work every day, and you had to keep your payments up. You didn't have much of a cushion, which is why I'm in favor of going back to some sane rules, saying, you know what, you need to have at least 20% down. You need to have a little cushion in the bank. You need to have some things in place before you buy a house. Because as we're seeing, too many people were put into houses that obviously they were, in the case of an emergency, were unable to hold on to. And, you know, also a new poll from the New York Times, CBS News, has found that, quote, the public steadfastly supports the president's proposal to let the tax cuts expire for the wealthiest Americans. 53% said it's a good idea, while 38% said it's a bad idea. The poll also found that far more people still blame Wall Street and the Bush administration than blame President Obama for the country's economic problems. If that's the case, and this is one of those things that makes me go, if that's the case, if you know where the blame's going, why are you punishing him? Why do you want to go back to the people who did this? Why would you want to revert to the policies that caused this problem? And it's just...
But there's a disconnect there, Rick, obviously. There's a disconnect. I read the same polls, and quite frankly, it surprised me. I guess maybe that says if the Democrats can limit the damage here, he still has a pretty good shot of getting reelected, unless they totally screw up, which I don't anticipate. I think this man can still be a good president. I think he can accomplish a lot, but he's going to have to survive. And the truth is, if the losses are too bad, the Democrats are in trouble. His administration is in trouble. Not to mention the future of this country, which is ultimately the most important thing.
Well, we've seen the first defection. Blue Dog Democrat Representative Gene Taylor has become the first member of the party to sign on to a pledge to repeal the recently passed health care law. The Heritage Action CEO Michael Needham said, "We're pleased to see Representative Gene Taylor choosing principle over party."
Oh, that's crap.
Heritage Action.
I would bet he's in a tough race, probably in a swing district, maybe even in a slightly Republican district. And he's looking to get reelected. I almost can guarantee that. Not about principle, it's about survival.
And Senator Jim Bunning, a Republican from Texas, thank goodness he's going away.
Yes, please.
Took to the Senate floor yesterday to recite a Tea Party poem explaining, quote, "I think it represents what most people across the country are feeling about their government." The poem warns, quote, "And rest assured, incumbents all, there's a rising in the land, and real and wanted change will come. Our future is at hand."
Isn't this the same nutbag case that held up unemployment compensation for a while?
Yes, yes, he is.
Oh, what a true American.
He's the guy who voted against helping the auto industry and then wanted to go to Detroit to sign baseball cards.
Well, you know, I have to admit, sorrowfully, he used to be my idol. He pitched, I can still remember his no-hitter against the Mets way back in the 60s. He was a pretty good pitcher, actually, but what happened on the way to the Senate, I'll never know. I don't know what he was drinking at home.
Boy, I'll tell you, that Kentucky race is another one of another Lulu race with Rand Paul. But the thing you got to say about the guy, at least he's honest. You know, he says crazy stuff, but I think he honestly believes it.
Oh, I believe he does. But aren't those people the most dangerous? People that truly believe it, or they truly believe that they have God's position. How can you argue with God?
You certainly can't. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back to wrap this up. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're right back after this.
I told you once tonight that you could always speak your mind. You worked so hard to say what's right. I watched you do it all the time.
The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Workers in the late 1930s began exerting their recently guaranteed right to organize and join unions. Millions of workers flocked to join the labor organization of their choosing to collectively bargain for better wages, hours, and working conditions. Factory, mill, and mine owners, not eager to embrace the changes, fought vehemently to deny workers their rights. As company tactics grew more heavy-handed and brutal, the workers' organizing methods changed. Sit-down strikes became a way for workers to demand their rights and to force management to listen. With a wave of a handkerchief, the tip of a hat, workers would shut down their machines, lay down their hammer, and sit down. Workers at the Hershey Chocolate Factory in Hershey, Pennsylvania, seeking to reduce the 60-hour-long work week, decided to form a union. Initially, an agreement was reached, but as the economy took a downturn, the company willfully violated the agreement by laying off the most senior workers, those who just happened to be the most ardent union supporters. The workers voted to strike the very next day. At 11 a.m. on April 2nd, 1937, a red handkerchief was waved and the workers began their first sit-down strike in Pennsylvania's history. The company reacted by forming the Loyal Workers Club. These strikebreakers consisted of hired thugs from New York City and local farmers, dairy producers, and shopkeepers who were dependent on the factory. On April 6, Hershey organized a loyalty parade. After hours of rallying speeches, the lathered-up Loyal Workers Club mob found pipes and clubs that had been manufactured at the Hershey planing mill. The angry mob headed to the Hershey factory to throw their strikers out. Songs of solidarity sung by the striking workers could be heard from inside the factory as the angry mob burst into the plant. Blocking the only exit, the Loyal Workers Club, loyal only to management and greed, began pummeling the workers as they tried to escape. The assault left numerous workers bloody and beaten, many unconscious. Within days, Hershey reopened and recognized a renamed version of the Loyal Workers Club. In May of 1938, the National Labor Relations Board ruled Hershey had violated the law and the company union was dissolved. Soon, the workers joined the Bakery and Confectionery Workers Local 464, who have faithfully represented the workers ever since. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Some politicians say the unemployed won't look for work until their benefits run out.
Ed has been laid off from his pipe fitting job for over 18 months.
I'm here to tell you, being out of work is no fun. It sets you back in life. Benefits provide for less than half your wages. There's no health care, and your family suffers. To those politicians who think anybody would rather be collecting unemployment than working, I say come join us. We won't forget on Election Day.
This Labor Day message brought to you by the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO, Richard Bloomingdale President, Frank Snyder, Secretary Treasurer.
And now, back to the Rick Smith Show.
Yes, waiting for the hammer to fall. I understand Stephen Colbert has named his rally Restoring Sanity. I think, if I remember right, that's one of our things, restoring sanity back to the political process, and it needs to happen. I mean, you look at Becca Palooza. Can you see? Look, folks. Wow, is that the America we want on display? Whoo! Mm. A whole lot of Lulu there. I mean, really, come on. I mean, the guy basically gave a religious sermon. And you know what's funny is you know, man. I don't even want to. Just move on. What do you got for me?
Paycheck Fairness Act. I think we touched on this some in the past. It passed the House of Representatives, but time is running out.
Let me guess. It's going to get bogged down in the
Senate. Yeah. I mean, you better sit down this one. You better sit down. It's a shock. Time's running out for the Senate to follow the lead of the House. It's Senate Bill 182, and the intention is to close the wage gap between men and women. The bill would deter wage discrimination by closing loopholes in the Equal Pay Act and barring retaliation against workers who disclose their wages to co-workers.
That's a big one. My wife told me that where she used to manage a building
office. I thought about your wife when I read it.
And you know, if one worker told another what they earned, they got fired. And yeah. Well, you're kidding me.
Nope.
And she's like, no. Oh, we can't talk about wages. Oh. I mean, I'm used to, you know, there being a book and right there in the book saying, okay, this is what you made. And everybody being open and honest about it, which is one of those things about, you know, when you talk about prevailing wage. I think what it is, you know, they say, oh, that's the union wage. No, that's the reported wage. And those are what the people who are proud of what they're paying their workers report. You know, the scumbag who's paying under the table at $5 an hour, he's not going to report that he's paying under the table $5 an hour. He's going to abstain from reporting. You know, the guy who's proud of the fact that I've got qualified workers who can make a decent living, and you know what? They can buy their own tools.
You know, I literally thought of your wife when I read that. Now there's an important number here, but just let me repeat what the president said.
Whoa. What are you thinking about my wife for?
No, what you had told me about what she had experienced in the workplace.
Yes,
let me clarify that.
Thank
there.
You.
Yeah. I don't want this big guy chasing me down the street here. This is what the president said about the bill. It's a common sense bill that will help ensure that men and women who do equal work receive the equal pay that they and their families deserve. Well spoken. Here's a number. Please call. It needs to be acted upon by the end of September. This is the number for Congress. 1-877. That's 1-877-667-6650. I'll repeat it one more time. 1-877-667-6650. Please call. It's important that we get this bill passed, and we got to push the Senate. Hopefully they'll take some action on it. It's long, long overdue.
Well, you know, hold on, wait a second. Whoa. I can feel conservative Rick coming into the picture. Coming down from the depths. Coming down, down to the depths. I don't want this bill to pass. Why? Because men will then have to make the same as women. And we're much more superior than women. You know, I've often said I would love to be an evangelical Christian. I would. I would love to live in a male-centric society where women bowed and you know, did my will.
Kind of like a Christian Taliban.
Yeah.
There you go.
Perfect. That's what Becca Palooza was about, right there. That was beautiful. But I would love to live in that, you know, me personally, I would love to live in that male-centric, women bow to my needs and take care of me and, you know, do all the things that they're supposed to do. My problem with that is I got two daughters, and there's just no way I would want my two daughters to be treated like that by some guy. I'm afraid I'd have to kill them. And I can understand it.
That's your worst nightmare, huh?
Oh, you have no idea.
That the young boys will you know, kind of act like you did when you were young, Rick?
Well, absolutely. That's it right there. That's my worst fear.
The father's ultimate nightmare.
But my
and they say there is no justice in the world.
But beyond that, I have this, you know, this nightmare that my daughters are going to bring home Larry the Cable Guy and Tucker Carlson. You know, that scares me.
I bet you do have nightmares. Your daughter's first date, and you're sitting there, and he knocks on the door.
Pointing the gun. Yeah. I actually had that happen once. I had
really?
A girl I was dating, her father was...
And her father got the gun out?
Cleaning the shotgun.
Was he sending you a message?
I hope so.
I believe so.
I hope he was.
Can I ask you a question? Maybe you want to talk off air.
Sure.
Did it work?
Did what work?
The intimidation.
No. That stuff never works. What that is that's something to chuckle about in the theater going, oh, my dad was trying to scare you. No.
As if you didn't know. Did she tell you that?
Of course. That stuff doesn't work.
Well, apparently it wasn't the first time he did it, I'm sure.
Well, you know, it works. When they grab you by the throat and they hold some oxygen away from you, that works. I've had that happen as well.
Really? And that worked?
That worked. I honestly thought he was crazy enough to kill me.
Well, then it worked.
That it sure did. Our last story of the night, an angry lawmakers push Geithner to toughen up on China. Agency France Press reports today that U.S. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner on Thursday said it was past time for China to lift barriers to U.S. exports as he faced angry lawmakers' demands for sanctions against Beijing. Geithner abandoned his previously restrained approach to bluntly warn China that it must let the yuan rise in value against the dollar to end trade distortions. Facing November elections shaped by voter anger at the sour economy, U.S. lawmakers are weighing bills that would slap sanctions on Chinese goods amid accusations that Beijing keeps its currency and thereby its exports artificially cheap. I think I've been screaming about that for, 5 years now on the air here in central Pennsylvania. I've been screaming for 5 years to do something about the Chinese and their cheating tactics. Now maybe are we going to get something? Are we going to get some movement? We shall see.
Just like healthcare, you got the vested interest, the corporate interest blocking it, unfortunately.
And, you know, I wonder about that. You know, I look at the tire case where, you know, finally Obama, you know, put some tariffs on Chinese, these crummy Chinese-made tires. And the American companies were against it. Why? Because that's where their manufacturing plants are.
They didn't want the Chinese government angry at them.
Well, I mean, they didn't want to have to move their plants back or somewhere else. You know, they invested a whole bunch of money over there to make big profits off the U.S. consumer.
I mean, think about that. Would the Chinese do that? I don't think they would. I mean, they love when American companies move their operations over.
Yeah, so they can retro-engineer it, and they can make their own brand name and undercut their competitors, us, which is what they've been doing. I mean, you look at all the Walmart brands; those are Chinese knockoffs because they don't honor licensing, they don't honor any patents, they don't honor any of that stuff. Why? Because they can get away with it because we're not willing. Anyway, I want to thank everybody for tuning in tonight. If you missed any part of it, you can go to thericksmithshow.com. You can watch. Well, I guess our Ustream isn't working tonight, but generally we put our show up on Ustream. You can watch it there. You can listen to clips at thericksmithshow.com. If you want to email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com, tell me what a great job I'm doing. Again, tomorrow night we're going to be tape delayed after the football game here on WIOO. And you know, wrapping up our first week as we move down. This has been a good week here so far. And we've enjoyed the interaction with the callers and with the people who have emailed us. Again, you can email me at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Thanks for tuning in. We will see you back here tomorrow night. Have a great night.
listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's color of life, the tide and flood beneath the sway, imperial, mysterious, and